Thank you. Distinguished participants of the plenary session, ladies, gentlemen, friends, I've had a look at the discussions that have taken place over these days here at Valdai. Very interesting, very substantive. I do hope that you do not regret coming to Russia. You have a chance to talk to one another. I'm very glad to see all of you. The Valdai Club gives us a forum to talk about tectonic shifts that are underway or that have already occurred in the world. We've spoken on many occasions about the risks associated with the decline of world institutions, the erosion of collective security principles, and the substitution of international law for the so-called rules. I wanted to say, you know who came up with those, but no one knows who came up with these rules, what underlies these rules, what's inside those rules. I think there is an attempt to introduce just one rule for the powers that be. The global powers that be should have a chance to do whatever they please and be, you know, able to do whatever without any punishment, with impunity. The value of the Valdai discussions consists in the fact that different assessments and forecasts are expressed here, and as to their accuracy, life itself has confirmed them with certainty, because the most rigorous and unbiased examiner is life. It shows how accurate our discussions in the previous years have been. Alas, the developments are following the negative scenario so far, and we spoke about this negative scenario on multiple occasions during previous meetings. Moreover, these developments have turned into a large-scale systemic crisis, not just militarily political, but also economic and humanitarian. The so-called West, as it were, because there is no unity, we understand that this is a very complex conglomerate, but be that as it may, let's call it the West. Over the recent years, and especially over the last months, has taken several steps towards escalation. And they're always trying to escalate. There's nothing new in that. They're fueling the war in Ukraine, organizing provocations around Taiwan, destabilizing the world food and energy markets. As far as the last one is concerned, it was not deliberate. We do not doubt that. It was due to a number of systemic errors committed by the Western authorities I've just mentioned. And as we can see, it's all been compounded by the destruction of European gas pipelines. This is incredible, but this is, however, something we're witnessing, these tragic events. Dominion of the world is precisely what the so-called West has decided to stake in this game. But this game is a dangerous, dirty, and deadly one. It contests the sovereignty of peoples and nations, their identity and uniqueness, and has no regard whatsoever for the interests of other countries. Well, we cannot say rejection directly, but this is basically what we see happening in life. And those who formulate these rules believe that others have no right to their unique path. Everyone needs to abide by these rules. And I would like to remind you of Russia's proposal addressed to our Western partners, the proposal to reinforce trust and build a system of collective security last December. Yet again, this proposal was cast aside. But in the modern world, it's not going to be possible to sit this one out. Whoever sows the wind will reap the whirlwind. The crisis has taken on a truly global magnitude. It affects everyone, and we should not entertain any illusions as to that. Humanity is essentially faced with two options. Either we continue accumulating the burden of problems that is certain to crush all of us, or we can work together to find solutions, functional if imperfect ones, solutions capable of rendering our world more stable and safer. You know, I've always believed in the power of common sense, and I still do. And that is why I'm convinced that sooner or later, both the new centers of a multipolar world and the West will have to embark upon an equal dialogue about our shared future. And the sooner that happens, the better, naturally. And in that regard, I would like to share with you some emphases which we find very important. The developments of today have relegated to the background environmental issues. As surprising as that may be, this is something I'd like to start with. And climate change is no longer in the headlines, but far from disappearing, these fundamental challenges are only growing worse. One of the most dangerous consequences of the environmental imbalance is a reduction in natural biological diversity. And right now I'd like to move to the topic we've all gathered for. Is other kind of diversity any less important? I refer to cultural, social, political, and civilizational diversity. At the same time, simplification, erasure of all differences, well, this is all but the essence of the modern world. But what is behind this simplification? First and foremost, it's the depletion of the West's creative potential and its desire to contain and to inhibit free development of other civilizations. There's also a direct self-serving interest hiding there. By imposing their values, consumer models, they seek to standardize these models. Our opponents, let me put it mildly, are trying to expand their markets for their products. So, you know, it's all very simple. And it's no coincidence that the West says that it's its culture and its world view that should be recognized as universal. They are not saying that outright, but this is how they behave. And they insist through their policies on everyone accepting these values unconditionally. Let me quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn's famous Harvard address. Back in 1978, he said that the West, let me quote, has a blindness of superiority that continues, and this is what happens, and upholds the belief that the vast regions everywhere on our planet should develop and mature to the level of present-day Western systems. It was back in 1978. Nothing has changed since then. Over the last 50 years or so, this blindness Solzhenitsyn spoke of, by its nature, it's racist and neocolonial, and it has taken on an unsightly form once the so-called unipolar world was established. But what can I say in response? Belief in one's own infallibility is a dangerous state because it's but one step away from a desire by those who deem themselves infallible to destroy, obliterate those they do not like, as they say, to cancel them. Let's think about the sense of this world, the meaning of it, even at the height of the Cold War, when the confrontation of systems, ideologies, and military machines were opposition was in full swing. It never occurred to anyone to reject, deny the very existence of culture, art, and science of your opponent. Yes, there were several restrictions with regard to educational, scientific, cultural, and regrettably sports relations. But be that as it may, both Soviet and American leaders of those days had an understanding that humanitarian field is very delicate. You've got to study your opponent and have respect for him, and sometimes even learn from him, to preserve a foundation for healthy, constructive relations for the future. But what is happening now? Back in their days, Nazis went as far as to burn books. Right now, the Western champions of liberalism and progress have slipped into banning Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky. The so-called cancel culture is basically a cancellation of culture that annihilates everything that is alive and creative. It stunts the growth of free thought in economy, politics, and culture. The very liberal ideology itself has today changed beyond recognition. In the very beginning, classical liberalism interpreted the freedom of each and every person as the freedom to say what you want, do what you want. But in the 20th century, liberals started to proclaim that the so-called open society has enemies. Well, it turns out open society has enemies. And the freedom of these enemies could and should be restricted have not abolished altogether. And right now, they've reached an absurd situation when any alternative point of view is declared to be a subversive propaganda and a threat to democracy. Whatever comes from Russia, well, it's all the Kremlin's doing, but they should look at themselves first. Are we all powerful? If we see any criticism with regard to our opponents, why is it seen as the Kremlin's doing? They should, you know, think harder. They have to present more conceptually their point of view. They cannot simply shift the blame on the Kremlin's intrigues. And all of these was prophetically described back in the 19th century by Fyodor Dostoevsky. One of the characters of his novel, The Possessed, Shigalov, a nihilist, describes the bright future he devised. I quote, "Starting from unlimited freedom, I arrive at unlimited despotism." And you know, our Western partners have arrived precisely at this point. And it's echoed by another character of the novel, Pyotr Verkhovensky, who says that what we need is universal betrayal, spying, and snitching. He says that society does not need talents nor superior capabilities. He says Cicero will have his tongue cut out, Copernicus will have his eyes put out, Shakespeare will be stoned. And this is what our Western opponents have come to. What is it if not the current Western cancel culture? Because it was a great thinker, you know. And I'm truly thankful to my assistants who've found these quotes. What can I say in response? History will set everything right. And it's not going to cancel the greatest universally recognized geniuses of the world culture. It's going to cancel those who presently have decided that they can do with the world culture as they please for some reason. And as they say, these people have an incredibly high opinion of themselves, but several years will pass and no one will remember their names, but everyone will remember Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky and Pushkin, whatever anyone says. Standardization, financial, technological monopoly, erasure of all and every difference. This has been the foundation of the Western globalizational model, whose nature is neo-colonial, basically, and the task was clear: to reinforce absolute dominion of the Western, the world economy and the world politics, to put to service natural, financial, intellectual, human and economic capabilities of the whole planet, doing that under the guise of the so-called new global interdependence. Let me recall yet another Russian philosopher here, Alexander Zinoviev. We are going to celebrate his centenary in a couple of days, on October the 29th. More than 20 years ago, he said that for the Western civilization to survive at the level it had attained, it would need, I quote, all of the planet as its habitat. It would need all the resources of humanity, and this is what they laid their claim to. You know, it's all true. And in this system, the West enjoys an inherent, incredible advantage because it came up with the principles and mechanisms of this system. The principles, you know, everyone is talking about. What are these principles? A black hole, no one understands. But once globalization started to benefit not Western countries but other countries, I refer first and foremost to big nations of Asia, the West either revisited many of the rules or even abolished some of them. And as far as the sacrosanct principles of free trade, economic openness and equal competition, even property are concerned, well, all of these principles were all of a sudden altogether forgotten. You know, when it was no longer beneficial, they decided to revisit the rules on the go. Yet another strawman argument and doublespeak. Western ideologues and politicians have long been telling the world there is no alternative to democracy. But in truth, what they meant was the Western, the so-called liberal democratic model, whereas all other variants and forms of democracy were rejected by them with disdain and arrogance. You know, it's been characteristic of them since the colonial times, because they think that everyone, you know, is just substandard, whereas only they belong to the elite. But right now, the absolute majority of the world community demands democracy in world affairs. They reject authoritarian diktat of certain countries or groups of countries. What is it, if not direct application of democratic principles in interstate affairs? But what is the position of the so-called civilized West? If you are Democrats, then one would think you would welcome this natural desire, aspiration towards freedom of billions of people. But it's not the case. The West calls that the sabotage of liberal world order based on rules, and it resorts to economic and trade war, sanctions, boycotts, color revolutions, and it hatches and conducts different kinds of coup d'etat. And, you know, they even say how much money they spend on the coup d'etat, the cheek of it. Well, what about Soleimani, who was taken out? You can think whatever you want about him, but it's an official, a dignitary. He was killed in the third country. So what is it? Washington, as its tradition, calls the current world order a liberal world order, but day in, day out, this world order begets more and more chaos. And it is becoming increasingly intolerant, even with regard to Western countries, should they attempt any kind of autonomy. And they even slap sanctions on their own allies unabashedly. And others are simply, you know, showing obeisance. Let's remember the July proposals of Hungarian parliamentarians who suggested that dedication to European Christian values and culture should be enshrined in a treaty on the European Union, but these attempts were seen not just as opposition, but hostile sabotage. You know, someone likes them, some others, but we in Russia, over thousands of years, have seen a peaceful coexistence of different religions, but we do not require that they should be changed, neither Christian values, nor Muslim values, nor other religious values. We have to treat one another with respect. In a number of regions, and I know that. I know that firsthand. People go together to celebrate Christian and Buddhist and Muslim and Jewish holidays. Well, I think it's worth speaking about at least. This testifies to the ideological crisis of the neoliberal model of the world order. In the American fashion, they have no creative or positive agenda. They have nothing to offer to the world apart from retaining their domination. A true democracy in a multipolar world requires an opportunity for every nation, every society, every civilization to choose their own path, their own social and political system. And if the US and the EU enjoy this rule, then Asian countries, Muslim countries, the Gulf monarchies and countries of other continents should have this right, and Russia too. And no one will ever be able to dictate to our nation what kinds of society and on what principles we should be building. A direct threat to the political, economic, and ideological monopoly of the West consists in the fact that the world can see the emergence of alternative social models, which can turn out to be more efficient, more vibrant, more attractive than the ones that exist as of now. And these models will emerge and develop. This is inevitable. Incidentally, American political scientists, experts, are writing on the subject directly, but the powers that be do not listen to them. But they can't help seeing that these ideas are being expressed and voiced on the pages of political science journals and in discussions. This development should be based upon a dialogue of civilizations, with an emphasis on spiritual and moral values. Yes, different civilizations have a different understanding of a human being and his nature, but it's only at the surface, because all of them recognize the highmost value and spiritual nature of a human being. And the foundation is of paramount importance, the foundation upon which our shared future is going to be built. I would like to point out the following. Traditional values are not a fixed set of principles everyone must abide by. Far be it from it. The difference from the so-called liberal values consists in the fact that all of them are unique because they stem from a tradition of concrete society, its culture and historical experience. This is why traditional values cannot be imposed on anyone. You need to simply have respect for them. Treat with care what has been devised ever centuries by each and every people, each and every nation. This is our understanding of traditional values, and this approach is shared and accepted by the majority of humanity. It's only natural, because traditional societies of the East, Latin America, Africa, and Eurasia form the backbone of world civilization. Respect for the unique characteristics of nations and civilizations, this is in the interest of nature and everyone, because it even suits the interests of the West, because it loses its superiority, turning into a minority in the world arena. And of course, the right of this Western minority to its own unique culture, unique identity, should be guaranteed. Unconditionally, we have to treat that with respect, but the same should apply to the rights of everyone else. If the Western elites believe that they can, you know, introduce into the society and the consciousness of the society such bizarre trendy notions as dozens of genders or pride parades, well, let them do that. Let them do whatever they want, but they do not have the right to demand that others should follow in their footsteps. As we can see, Western countries are undergoing complex demographic, political, and social processes. It's their domestic affairs. Russia does not interfere within these affairs, nor is it going to, unlike the West, we're not getting into someone else's backyard. But we hope that pragmatism will emerge victorious, and the dialogue between Russia and the genuine traditional West, as well as other equal centers of development, all of that is going to be an important contribution to the construction of a multipolar world order. I would like to remind you that the multipolar world is the real, the only chance for Europe to rebuild its political and economic autonomy. Well, I'm not going to hide it. We understand, and even Europe says it. Right now, this autonomy of Europe, let me put it mildly, not to offend anyone, this autonomy is very restricted.
The world is diverse in its nature, and the attempts of the West to make everyone fit the mold are objectively doomed. Nothing will come of it. The overconfident strive to global leadership and, in essence, to dictate, or maintaining the leadership through dictate, is, in reality, leading to the lower international standing of the U.S., including the U.S. It leads to growing mistrust to their capability to deal with anyone in general. One thing today, another thing tomorrow. You sign the document and then you tear it apart. There is no stability whatsoever in anything. How we can talk to them, sign documents? Can we rely on them? It's unclear. Before, only some countries allowed themselves to argue with America, and that looked like almost scandalous. And now it's a routine thing when very different countries refuse Washington in its baseless demands, despite the fact that it still is trying to apply pressure to everyone. I think this is a very wrong policy. It's a road to nowhere. But let it be. It's their choice. I'm convinced that the people of the world would not disregard the policy of intimidation that has discredited itself. And every time for the attempts to maintain its hegemony, the West will have to pay, and to pay a higher price each time. If I were a Western elite, I would seriously think about this future. Just like today, some political scientists and politicians are contemplating in the U.S. itself. In the current situation of harsh conflict, I'd like to say a matter of principle that Russia, being an independent and unique civilization, has never considered itself an enemy of the West. Americanophobia, Anglophobia, Francophobia, Germanophobia, just the same kind of racism is as Russophobia and anti-Semitism, just like any other manifestation of xenophobia. We simply need to clearly understand, as I have said before, there are at least two types of West, maybe more. There is the West of traditional, primarily Christian values, freedom, patriotism, and rich culture, and now of Islamic values as well. A significant amount of population professes Islam. And this kind of West is close to us. We have common roots based in classical antiquity. But there is another kind of West, aggressive, cosmopolite, neocolonial, being a weapon of neoliberal elites. And Russia, naturally, will never make peace with the dictate of this kind of West. In 2000, after I was elected the president, I remember fully well, and I'll always remember this, I remember what price we've paid for annihilating the terrorist den in the Northern Caucasus when the West has practically openly supported here. Grown-up people here, and you know what I'm talking about here. We all know that was the fact of life. It was financial, political, and information support that was rendered. We've all lived through that. Moreover, the West did not only actively support terrorists on the territory of Russia, but it has largely nurtured this threat. We knew that. Nevertheless, after the situation has stabilized, when main terrorist groups were decisively defeated, thanks to the courage of the Chechen people as well, we've made the decision not to look back, not to hold grudges, but rather to move forward and to build relations, including with those who basically worked against us. We decided to build relations with everyone who wanted to do that, based on mutual benefit and respect to each other. We thought it was in our common interest. Thank God, Russia has survived through all the hardships of that time. We persevered, we coped with domestic/external terrorism. We maintained our economy, and it continued to grow. Our military capacity increased. We're trying to build relations with the leading countries of the West, with NATO as well. We had one message. Let's stop being an enemy to each other. Let's live in harmony. Let's build a dialogue, build trust, and, therefore, peace. In that, we were absolutely sincere. I'd like to highlight that. We understood clearly how complex such rapprochement would be. We still did it. But what did we get in return? In a nutshell, it was basically a no on all main dimensions of possible cooperation. What we got in return is permanent pressure on us and creating hotbeds of tension at our borders. And if I may ask, what was the goal of that pressure? What was the goal? Just to practice? Well, of course not. The goal was to make Russia more vulnerable and to turn Russia into a tool of achieving their own geopolitical goals. That's it. That's the rule of the thumb. Everyone is turned into a tool, and to use these tools to their own ends. And those who do not obey to this pressure, who doesn't want to be a tool, sanctions are introduced against them. Economic restrictions are introduced against them. Coup d'etats are being prepared and executed where possible, and so on. And in the end, if they do not succeed in anything, then the main goal is to eliminate, to wipe off the map. But that didn't work with Russia, and it will never happen. It will never be possible to implement this scenario. Russia does not challenge the elites of the West. Russia is simply standing up to its right to exist and to freely develop. We ourselves do not intend to become a new hegemon. Russia does not offer to substitute unipolarity, unipolar world with bipolar or tripolar world, domination of the West with domination of the East or North or South. That would lead to yet another dead end. And I would like to quote the words of a great Russian philosopher, Nikolai Danilevsky, who believed, and I quote, that the progress is not everyone marching in the same direction as our opponents are trying to make us, but rather, well, the progress would soon cease in that case, says Danilevsky. But the idea of the progress is to walk and explore the whole field of historically human domain in all directions. And he adds, not a single one civilization can be proud of presenting the apex of development, end of quote. I'm convinced that dictatorship can only be countered through the freedom of development of countries and nations, identity loss countered through the love to human being as a creator. The primitive simplification and bands can be countered through the flourishing complexity of cultures and tradition. The main idea of today's point in time is that all civilizations, states, and their integration associations indeed have opened all paths to pave their own democratic and original path. Primarily, we believe that the new world order should be based on law and justice. It should be free, fair, and unique. The world economy and trade should become more fair and open. Russia believes that it is unavoidable that the new international financial platforms will take shape, also for international payments. Such platforms should be outside of any national jurisdiction. They should be safe, depoliticized, automatic, and they should not depend on one single governance center. Is it possible? Yes. It would require a lot of effort and joining efforts of many countries, but it is possible. And that would rule out the possible abuse in new global financial infrastructure. It would allow to effectively, beneficially, and safely and securely do without dollar and other so-called reserve currencies in international payments. The most so since the West has discredited the Institute of International Reserves using dollar as a weapon. First, they were depreciated through inflation in dollar and eurozone, and later, they have effectively pocketed our assets, snippety-snap. Transition to payments in national currencies will gain momentum, unavoidably. Naturally, that will depend on the state of the economies of the emitting countries and so on. But still, these payments will become predominant. That is the logic of sovereign economy and financial policy in the multipolar world. Moving on. Today, new centers for global development already possess unique technology and scientific developments in very diverse spheres. And in many dimensions, they can successfully compete with the Western transnational companies. It is apparent that we have common and rather pragmatic interest in an honest and open scientific and technological exchange. Together, everyone will benefit more than separately. The majority should benefit, but not the separate ultra-rich corporations. What's happening today? If the West is selling medicine or seeding material to other countries, then they give the order to kill off national pharmaceutical and selection industry. In reality, everything boils down to that. When the West procures machine tools and equipment, that wrecks local machine building. When I was the chairman of the government, I remember it was very simple. As soon as you open your market for a certain item, goods, then the local producer is going down and it's almost impossible to bring back the industry. That's the way they build the relations. That's how they take over markets and resources. The countries are left without their technological and scientific potential. That is not progress, that is enslavement, bringing down the economy to a primitive level. Technological development should not exacerbate global inequality, but rather decrease it. That is the tradition for Russian foreign policy and technology. For example, when we are building nuclear power plants in other countries, we simultaneously are creating their centers of excellence and nurture local talent. We create the whole industry. We don't just build one plant. We build the whole industry. And in essence, we give other countries an opportunity to make a real breakthrough in their scientific and technological development, to bridge the inequality gap, and to bring their energy to the new level of efficiency and environmental friendliness. I'd like to highlight once again, sovereignty and independent development does not mean isolation or autarky, but that, on the contrary, means active cooperation, mutually beneficial cooperation based on justice and equal rights. If the liberal globalization brings about depersonalization and imposing the Western model on everyone around the world, then integration, on the contrary, is tapping into potential of each civilization in the interests of the whole for a common good. If globalism means dictate, that what it boils down to, then integration is finding common strategies beneficial to everyone. In this regard, Russia believes necessary to more actively launch mechanisms of creating larger spaces built on cooperation between neighboring countries whose economy, social system, resources, and infrastructure complement each other. Such large spaces, in essence, are the foundation for the multipolar world order, the economic foundation. The dialogue of such spaces gives birth to true unity of humankind, much more complex, unique and multidimensional than in simplified versions of Western ideologists, well, some of them at least. The unity of humanity cannot be built according to the order, be like us, do like us. It's taken shape with consideration to the opinion of everyone, with careful treatment of identity of each community and nation. Only this principle can be the foundation for long-term cooperation in multipolar world. In this regard, maybe we should think about the structure of the United Nations, including its Security Council, how it should better reflect the multitude of global regions, because it is Asia, of Africa, Latin America of tomorrow will be defining much more than it is commonly thought today. And that is a positive thing. I'd like to remind you that the Western civilization is not the only one in our common Eurasian space. Moreover, the majority of the population is situated in the east of Eurasia, which was the cradle of the ancient civilizations of humanity. The value and significance of Eurasia is that this continent is a self-reliant complex which has tremendous resources of all kinds and wonderful opportunities. The harder we work on greater interconnectedness in Eurasia, on creating new paths and forms of cooperation, the more tangible result we'll achieve. Successful activity of Eurasian economic unity, rapid growth of clout and influence of Shanghai Cooperation Organization, large-scale initiatives in One Belt, One Road initiative, plans for multilateral cooperation on implementation of the transportation corridor north-south and many other projects in that part of the world, I'm sure, bringing in the dawn of the new era, of the new stage in Eurasian development. Integration projects here do not compete, but rather complement each other. Naturally, if they are implemented by the neighboring countries in their own interests and not introduced by external forces in order to drive a wedge in Eurasian space and to turn into a zone of block standoff. A natural part of the greater Eurasia could be its western tip of the continent, I mean Europe, but many of its leaders are blinded by the convincement, by their idea that Europeans are better than others, that it's beneath them to cooperate in some endeavors as equals with others. And with this arrogance, they somehow did not notice that they've turned to be into periphery to others, quite often into vassals without the right of vote. Colleagues, the collapse of the Soviet Union has destroyed the equilibrium of the geopolitical forces. The West has felt that it's the winner and has proclaimed a unipolar world order, where only its will, its culture, and its interests had the right to exist. Now this historical period of undivided domination of the West is coming to an end. It's becoming the thing of the past. I mean the unipolar world. We are facing a historic milestone. Ahead of us is possibly the most dangerous, unpredictable, and at the same time crucial decade since the end of the Second World War. The West is incapable of unilaterally governing the humanity, however it desperately tries to do that. The majority of the nation does not want to make peace with that. That is the main contradiction of the new era. The situation is rather revolutionary if we apply to the classics. Well, if we speak in the words of the classics, the elites do not want the change, but the poor do not cannot live any longer with that. How to solve the issues of tomorrow is the main task for humanity. That is a painful and natural, though unavoidable, process. The future world order is being shaped before our eyes. And in this case, we need to listen to everyone, to hear out every point of view, every nation, every society, culture, and religious ideas without imposing a single truth upon anyone. And only on the basis of that, understanding our responsibility for the destiny of the planet, we should build the symphony of human civilization. I think I would like to wrap up with that, and I would like to thank you for the patience that you have shown me listening to my statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this all-encompassing address. I can't help but, you know, take up from where you left. You remember the revolutionary situation, the elites, the people. Whom do you associate yourself? Well, with the people, of course, because I am, you know, below from the people. I said that on multiple occasions. My mother, my family, my parents, they were workers. They, you know, some, they didn't even have vocational training. She used to work as a nurse, a nanny, and my father used to work as a night warden. He didn't want to leave me at the kindergarten. And this has always been the case with me. I listen to the pulse of popular life, how rank and file citizens live. So internationally you are on the side of those who do no longer want. Well, you know, I advocate what I've just said. I advocate democratic relations with due regard for the interests of all participants of international cooperation, not just the interests of the so-called Golden Billion. Yes, I understand that. We met 1 year ago. Back then, there was some tension in the international affairs, but when we look at October last year, it seems an idyll. A lot has changed over the last year. The world has been turned upside down, as some put it. To you personally, what has changed over the year that has passed internally, in your perception of the world and of the country? What's been happening, what is still happening in Ukraine in particular? Well, these are not changes that are currently underway or are underway since the beginning of the special military operation. No, these changes have been happening for many years now. Some have been paying attention, others have not, but these are tectonic shifts of the whole global order. You know, these tectonic plates are constantly shifting and moving, and as experts say, first, it's all very calm, very tranquil. These plates are on the move constantly. Then they come against one another, the tensions build up, and an earthquake happens. So this is how it happened here. First, an accumulation of tensions and then a flare-up. But these changes used to happen in the past because new centers of power are emerging, and I'm not the only one to say that. These changes are happening due to objective reasons. Some power centers are wilting, and I'm not going to say why that is happening. This is only a natural process, a process of bloom and perish and change. New ones are emerging mostly in Asia, but also in Africa. Yes, Africa is still a very poor continent so far. But you see the great potential to tap into. And the same applies to Latin America, and these changes will happen, these tectonic shifts. And it's the West that has driven us to this point. If there are any more questions, I'm ready to get back to what has happened in Ukraine. We were not the ones to organize a coup d'etat in Ukraine, which resulted in a series of tragic events, including our special military operation. We are not the ones who did it, but that does not matter. What matters is that tectonic shifts are always happening, and they will continue to happen independent of our actions. Our actions are simply highlighting more vibrantly what's happening, and they can push forward a little bit these processes that accelerate as compared to how they were unfolding before. But on the whole, these processes are inexorable and inevitable, and they would have happened regardless of how Russia could have acted in Ukraine. But what about our country? Something new over the last year? As far as Russia goes, yes, there are some issues. I referred to losses incurred due to the special military operation, and I always say that. Yes, there are economic losses. But there are also enormous acquisitions. What is happening, indubitably, in the end, I emphasize that, in the end, will benefit Russia and its future. Why is that? Because it'll help reinforce our sovereignty in all domains, and in particular in the economic field. Just some time ago, with anxiety, we were thinking that we were turning into some kind of a semi-colony because we could not do anything without our Western partners. We could not conduct financial transactions. We did not have the technology. We thought we would be devoid of the markets or sources of new technology. We didn't have anything. They could simply, you know, flick their finger and everything in Russia would collapse. But it didn't. And the fundamentals of our economy turned out to be far stronger than anticipated by others, even by ourselves. And this purification, this better understanding of our capabilities, this adaptability and the current conditions, as well as the objective need, not just to accelerate import substitution, but also to replace those who are leaving our markets. All of this has demonstrated that our businesses are capable of taking the place of those who are leaving. Those companies are whispering to us, we're not leaving for good, we will soon get back, but they're still selling billions in assets at $1. They are doing that. They are selling it to the management. So there is an agreement. They intend to get back. Well, how else? Certainly, it's not a gift to these individuals. We understand the sentiment. We know it. And this is of great importance. we have come to realize in the end. We've always been saying that we are a great country, but now we understand that we can do it. We understand the consequences, the bad consequences in the midterm, because they are, you know, shutting down access to technology for us, but that is what they were doing before. Of course, right now the situation is more difficult, but it turns out that we can do it. Another important component, you know, a spiritual one, probably the most important one. First, you know, this motto, we are not leaving anyone. And this is a motto which has been embedded deep in the hearts of each and every Russian and other citizens of Russia. The willingness to fight for our people leads to greater unity in society, and this has always been our country's strong suit. We've confirmed it and reinforced it. And during the last year, has there been anything in our country that has turned out to be true disappointment for you? Well, no. So no conclusion should be made, no changes. Well, these conclusions, we need them all the time, organizational conclusions, especially human personnel, human resources. We have to think about training new specialists, new workers. We need to find new people who are capable of working at a better level than the previous generation. But I cannot say that there is anyone who turned out to be disappointing to me that I have to, you know, let someone go. Very good. Thank you. Mr. President, in February you took the decision to launch a special military operation. It came as a surprise to all, especially to the majority of Russian citizens. On many occasions, you've given an explanation of the rationale as well as the causes, but still, this is a decision of such magnitude which cannot be taken without a special impetus, a special nudge. What did happen before this decision was taken? I said that on multiple occasions. I do not think I am going to say anything new, especially in this room, in this audience. I'm not going once again to talk about the NATO expansion, which was absolutely unacceptable. Everyone knew that. Simply ignoring outright our interests in the field of security. And in the end of last year, you know, yet another attempt we made with our proposals. It was cast aside. They said, you know, just, I'm not going to say the words, but it was ignored, our proposal. With the support of their Western patrons, Kyiv authorities publicly refused to abide by the Minsk agreements. The leader said that they didn't like one point of the Minsk agreements. He said that publicly. Other high officials said that they were not going to stick to the Minsk agreements. The previous president said that he did sign the Minsk agreements, but he assumed that they would never be implemented. What else is there to say? If you need to embed something into the consciousness of millions with you know, internet, with the media, this is one thing. And another thing is real politics, because there are some things that are happening and that are not being, you know, seen by people. And finally, you know, real things came to light, became public, and we had to decide what to do with Donbas, because people were living for 8 years under fire and they're still living under fire. We had to make a decision nonetheless, recognize their independence. But simply recognizing their independence and leaving them to their own devices, that was unacceptable. That is why we took the next logical step to incorporate them into the Russian Federation, because they would not survive on their own. They expressed their will. We know their sentiment. And of course, the fire still continued to rain, and Kyiv authorities were prepared to conduct new military operations because there had been previously two more military operations, and people were still living under the fire, and we had no other choice but to launch a military operation because, well, the other option was to simply wait for the Kyiv authorities to begin a new military operation. That was the rationale behind our decision. Let's get back to 2014. Why did they need to execute this coup d'etat? Because Yanukovych all but renounced authority. He agreed to hold elections, and I do hope he's not going to take offense. He stood little chance of winning. So why did they need this violent, anti-constitutional coup d'etat? There is no response. Probably the response is to demonstrate who the master was, you know, to tell everyone to do as they are bidden. There is no other explanation I can think of. Once the coup d'etat was executed, people refused to accept that, and this is what triggered the string of tragic events. The West could have implemented the Minsk agreements. Well, they're telling me that if I had been in the shoes of the then Kyiv authorities, I would have signed these agreements as well. But they did sign them. And the heads of those unrecognized People's Republics also put their signatures to the document. One of them was later assassinated. So all of these actions resulted in the current tragic events. That's it. Do you have this sentiment that society has, that the enemy has been underestimated? Well, you know what the thing is? We saw what had been happening. 8 years, they had been building fortifications in the Donbas, very strong fortifications. Secondly, we understood full well that this process would continue. And the further it went, the more dangerous it would have been for us, and the greater our losses would have been. And this is why we did it. And NATO was expanding its military presence in Ukraine, and these fortifications would have popped up not just along the line of contact. They would have popped up in different areas as well. And from the south, from the north, our troops are going around the Donbas, and if we had allowed it to run further, if they had a chance to acquire new weapons systems, then the situation for Russia would have been absolutely different from the point of view of running this special military operation. On multiple occasions, you said and you wrote in your article that we are one nation. Did you change your opinion? No, because it's a fact, a historical fact. In the 9th century, these territories saw the birth of Russian statehood, first in Novgorod, then in Kyiv, and then they joined together. It was one nation that spoke one language, ancient Russian, old Russian, and the changes in the language started to happen only in the 14th century, in the 15th century, due to the Polish influence, because the western parts of the Russian state ended up in a different country, and hence the changes in the language. During the development of an ethnic group, different things happen. If one part of an ethnic group achieves a level when they think of themselves as a separate nation, you have to treat that with respect. But this principle But this process happened due to a number of reasons. Some territories of Russia ended up in other countries, and these countries were pursuing their own interests. In Poland, these Russian territories were being Polonized, and heavy influence was exercised on the Russian language. You can look up the documents in the archive, and you can see letters to Warsaw, to Moscow, saying we are Russian Orthodox people, are asking Moscow, and so on and so forth. They asked Moscow to take them in the country, and they asked Poland to respect their tradition and their customs. And that is what they wrote. They wrote, we are Russian Orthodox people. Yes, afterwards, different processes started to happen. Then an enormous Russian Empire was born. European countries tried to set up, and they did, a certain barrier around the Russian Empire. You know, this principle that goes back to the classical antiquity, divide and conquer. And that is when these attempts started to happen, to divide and conquer the Russian nation. This happened in the 19th century, and then it was growing in magnitude, and it was supported by the West. And some people liked that. They liked that their language was unique, their customs were unique. This is the result of this divide and conquer policy. There's nothing surprising in that. Yes, they did achieve their goals, certain goals. And then it led to collaboration with Hitler during the Second World War, when Ukrainian collaborationists were used in actions aimed at eliminating Russians, Poles, Belarusians. It is a historical fact, well known. The most violent, terrible affairs were given to Bandera followers. This is part of our history. But basically, Russians and Ukrainians are one nation. This is historical fact. So it's a civil war to a certain extent. Yes, to a certain extent, we ended up in different countries, regrettably, due to a number of reasons.
First and foremost, because when the Soviet Union was created after the breakdown of the Russian Empire, and I wrote it multiple times in my articles, the Bolshevik leadership made the decision to pacify the nationalist sentiment who were originally from the Ukraine, and to give them originally Russian territories without asking the population who were living in that. In those territories, they gave the Black Sea region and Donbass over. First, Donbass was given to Russia. Then the delegation from the Ukraine came over. They came to speak to Vladimir Lenin. He invited the representatives from Donbass and said that we need to redecide. So they redecided, and they gave Donbass to Ukraine. In that sense, the Ukraine was and sort of an artificial state that came together. After the Second World War, and it's a historic fact, Stalin gave over a number of Hungarian, Polish, and Romanian territories to Ukraine, taking away their territories from the countries. The Polish people, who did not take part in the Hitler coalition, took over some of the German, East German territories. That is how the modern Ukraine came to life. What I'm thinking right now, and it just came to my mind, the only true guarantor of the Ukrainian statehood, sovereignty, and territorial integrity could have been only Russia, which has indeed created the modern Ukraine. Well, if we talk about guarantees, I remember we spoke about that in the spring. Then it went off the radar? I think it's a rhetorical question, considering that there are hostilities and many things happen there. But both you and the Russian officials have said multiple times that the special military operation is going according to the plan. So what is the plan? The society does not really comprehend the plan. You know, initially, I said it right on the day of the beginning of the special military operation. The main thing is to help Donbass. I have already said that. If we acted differently, we could not place our armed forces around Donbass from two sides then, if we acted differently. The second thing, Luhansk People's Republic is fully liberated. Their military action taking place around Donetsk Republic. When our troops came from the south and the north, and it became apparent that the people who live there on these traditionally, historically Russian territories see their common future with Russia, we couldn't help but respond. Therefore, the events took place, and we all saw that. And that was the logical follow-up to the situation that was happening at that point in time. The plan and the goal has been one, to help people who live in Donbass. That is what we proceed from. And specifically, what the general staff is planning. Well, I do know what they have in mind, but I don't think that's the case when I need to go into details. Thank you. Dear friends, I have satisfied my initial curiosity by monopolizing president, and now everyone can ask the question or questions. Let's begin with Ivan Safranchuk. Ivan Safranchuk, MGIMO University. You said that ahead of us we have a very important decade in development of the world and our country. But I have an impression there is a certain door into that decade. So I have the question about this door. If you could speak up into the microphone, I cannot really hear you. Lately, there is a great increase in nuclear rhetoric. Ukraine went from irresponsible statements to practical preparation for nuclear provocation. And representatives in the U.S. and in the United Kingdom are making statements where we hear certain overtones of the possibility of admissibility of using the nuclear weapon. Biden speaks about nuclear Armageddon, and we hear comments from the U.S. that, well, it's not that scary. At the same time, the U.S. Are speeding up the modernized tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. So what's happening is that there is nuclear saber-rattling, but they do not recognize the lessons of the Cuban missile crisis. If you could explain, Mr. President, is indeed the world on the threshold of a possibility of the use of nuclear weapons? And what would Russia do in this case as a responsible nuclear world power? Well, look, when the nuclear weapons exist, there is always a danger of them being used. Second, the goal of today's fuss around the nuclear threats and the possible use of the nuclear weapons is rather primitive. I don't think I'll be very much mistaken when I say what the goal is. I've already mentioned the dictate of the Western countries and their attempt to apply pressure to all participants in the world arena, including the neutral or countries friendly to us, that all comes to a nod. They're looking for additional arguments to encourage and convince our friends or neutral states that they need to altogether stand up to Russia. The provocations with the use of nuclear weapons, building tensions about the very notion of Russia using the nuclear weapons, have been put to use to this end to have an impact on our allies and our friends and neutral states and to tell them, look at who you're supporting. Russia is so scary. You shouldn't support it anymore. Don't cooperate with it. Don't buy anything from them. Don't sell anything to them. That is a very primitive goal. What's happening in reality? We've never said anything proactively about possible use of nuclear weapons by Russia. We have only hinted in response to those statements that the Western leaders have made. Madam Liz Truss, the ex-prime minister of the United Kingdom, she said it directly. In her conversation with a representative of the media, she said that the UK is a nuclear power and the prime minister has in his mandate the possible use of nuclear weapons. Well, I'm not quoting her. And she said that she's prepared to do that. And no one responded in any way. Well, she just made a folly. She was a bit out of it. But can you say these things publicly? Well, even if she said it, someone should have corrected that. Washington, for example, could have said that they have nothing to do with that. They don't know anything about it. There shouldn't be any offense made, but just to distinguishing themselves from that. And what we are to think, we think that this is a coherent position, that we have been blackmailed, and what should we do in response? Pretend that we haven't heard anything. A series and other statements were made on that matter. The leadership of the Kiev regime is constantly speaking about its strive to have a nuclear weapon. Now that's the first part of it. And now there are more discussions about what we're doing at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. So what are we doing? They're saying that quite directly, but they're always hinting that we're shelling and the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Are they out of their minds? Well, we're controlling this nuclear power plant. We have our troops based there. I've spoken to one of Western leaders. It's been several months since then. We're saying, what should we do? They're telling us to withdraw heavy weaponry from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. We said, consider that done. There are no heavy weapons there. Well, get rid of other weapons as well. Well, it's nonsense. You're laughing. It seems laughable. But I'm basically giving their statements verbatim. I said that you asked for representatives of IAEA to be based there. We have agreed to that. They are there. They even refuse to live in a hotel. They're living right on the territory of the nuclear power plant. And they can see with their own eyes who is shelling and where the projectiles are coming from. But no one is saying that Ukrainian troops are shelling the nuclear power plant. No one. However, they're building tension and building hype, accusing Russia. That's nonsense. It seems it should be nonsense, but that's really happening. I've also said it publicly already. I think there are three or four high-voltage transmission lines that have been downed by the Kiev regime around the Kursk nuclear power plant. Unfortunately, FSB didn't catch them, but I hope they will in the future. The sabotage was done. Well, they've done it. We informed all our Western partners, but silence is what we received in response. They did not respond in any way. So they're striving to have some kind of a nuclear incident to lay the blame at the Russian door and to start the new spiral of fighting against Russia, sanctions against Russia, and so on. I don't see any other point other than that. That is what's happening. Now, a new idea. We have published the intelligence data for a reason about an incident with a dirty bomb being prepared. We know where it is done, more or less. there is still some nuclear fuel that has been repurposed. The technologies that the Ukraine has allow them to do that. They've loaded up to Tochka-U missile, or they could blow up and say that Russia did that, that Russia has conducted a nuclear strike. But it doesn't make sense for us to do it, neither politically nor military. Still, it's been done. And I gave the instructions to Minister Shoigu to call all of his colleagues and to inform them about that. We cannot disregard such things. And now they say that IAEA wants to come over and to check the nuclear installations in the Ukraine. We are for it. It needs to be done as soon as possible. And the inspection should be as wide as possible, because we know that right now the Ukrainian authorities are trying to get rid of all the traces of their preparations. We know that. And now, as for, in the end, about use and non-use, and the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear state is the United States. They did it twice against Japan. What was the goal? There was no military purpose in that. It brought zero benefit militarily. It made no sense to use the weapon against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, against civilians, basically. Was there a threat to territorial integrity of the U.S. or their sovereignty? No, of course not. There was no point militarily to do that. The war machine of Japan was already broken down. They could not put up any resistance, basically. Why did they need to kill off Japan with a nuclear weapon? Japanese textbooks usually mention that the Allies have conducted a nuclear strike against Japan. So Japan is in such a grip that they cannot write the truth in their own textbooks. But they remember this tragedy every year. Still, well done. The Americans, well, we should follow suit. They're well done, you know. That's what's happening. So the U.S. is the only country in the world who has used nuclear weapons. And it was done by them because they believed it to be in their interests. As for Russia, we have our military doctrine. Let them read it. There are specific articles in the doctrine dedicated to the cases and how Russia believes it possible to use the weapons of mass destruction as nuclear weapons to protect its sovereignty, territorial integrity, and to ensure the safety of the Russian people. Tomorrow, we're celebrating 60 years since the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they decided to pull back. Can you imagine yourself in the role of one of the leaders? Well, apparently Khrushchev. Not in any case, no. We'll not get to that. Well, I cannot imagine myself as Khrushchev. Not in any case. Well, as a leader who will have to solve this kind of issue, we are prepared to solve any kind of issue. We do not refuse to do that. December last year, we have proposed to the United States to continue our dialogue on strategic stability. No response since December last year. We've received silence. If they want to, we're prepared. But if they don't, it's okay. We're developing our own modern technologies and delivery systems, including hypersonic weapon systems. We're self-reliant. We don't need anything. It is clear that they will catch up with us on hypersonic and so on. It's apparent that it's a high-tech country. It's a matter of time. But they're yet to catch up with us, and we have everything. We're developing these technologies. If someone wants to build a dialogue with us on that, we're prepared. Rasaran Maharaj, please.
You have answered a direct point that I raised earlier, but if I could expand upon what I'd asked. Escalating and accelerating crises continue to further reveal the precarity, the precarious position we are in and what our system currently is driving us towards. So unequal exchange continues, as you pointed out. Inequitous distribution, especially of human capacity, capability, and competence, render future prospects of reconciliation and reform inside an unfair yet hegemonic system extremely bleak. Sanctions, fear of reprisals, have rendered monetary sovereignty meaningless, especially with the weaponization of the payment system. In our contemporary conjuncture, what could then constitute a more democratic and workable alternative to the current international system of payments and settlements?
This is one of the key questions. One of the key questions of today's development and the future, not only the financial system, but also of the global world order. I think you've hit the bullseye here. After the Second World War, the U.S. has created a Bretton Woods system and has fortified it and enforced it in many dimensions. They've created international institutions under their control. In the sphere of finance, international trade. Now, these systems are failing. And a major mistake by the U.S. was to use dollar as a weapon in the fight for their political interest. That undermines the trust to dollar and other reserve currencies. It undermines the trust drastically, and I know what I'm talking about here. Now everyone is doubting whether they should have international reserves in dollars. It's not that easy to step out of dollar system because they have created a powerful system that keeps all the reserves in their grip. It's very hard to de-dollarize, but everyone is thinking about the future. I've already said it, but it bears repeating. How we see the future of the international financial system? Well, it's a general message, but still, each country should have opportunity for sovereign development, and it should be ensured, and we need to treat with respect the choice of every country. That's important, also in respect to international financial system. It should be independent, depoliticized, and naturally it should be based on the financial system of the leading countries of the world. If it will be created, and it's a very complex process, still it is possible. Then the international institutions will work more efficiently as well.
They have to be either reformed or built anew. And these institutions will provide assistance to those countries that are in need of such help. And first and foremost, this new financial system should be built and created in such a way that it transfers knowledge and technology. And if we do that, if we bring all these components together, then the very economic model and the financial system will meet the interests of the majority, not just the interests of the so-called golden billion, which we have been speaking about. And as a precursor to this system, we could cite the need for expanding transactions and settlements denominated in national currencies. Given the fact that the U.S. financial authorities are using dollar as a weapon, hampering transactions, not just in our case and our partners, but also in the case of other countries, well, given that, this desire for independence will push forth transactions denominated in national currencies. I think in India, 53% of our transactions are done in national currencies, and 27% with some other countries, and we are also creating the same system for other countries. In China, we are carrying out transactions in rubles and renminbi, and the same goes for other counterparts. as far as our own financial system is concerned, I think the main avenue is to create a system that is depoliticized, that is based upon national monetary systems. And this should be built to create a supranational currency system that is going to secure transactions. This is possible. This is practicable. And now we are first making steps in transactions in national currencies, and then we'll propel that to the regional level. I think this process will continue. Thank you. Colleagues, please introduce yourselves when you ask a question. Alec Iskanderen, please. Mr. President, I have come from Armenia. My question is about my country and my region. Recently, we have been hearing an increasingly vibrant discussion about a treaty prepared between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And these discussions highlight that there are two competing projects, the Russian project with Russia as an intermediary and the West project, with the West. The situation is a risky one. And across the region, the situation is volatile, teeming with risks. What does Russia think in that regard? How is Russia going to respond to this situation? What does Russia plan to do in this context in future? Thank you. Thank you. I don't know whether this was said publicly before. Maybe it was said, but be that as it may, I'm going to say that. Even if it was not said publicly, I do not think this is a secret. For many years, we've been engaged in dialogue with the Armenian side. We were proposing that the Nagorno-Karabakh issue should be settled in the following manner. Armenia was in control of seven areas of Azerbaijan, and Armenia said that they should be moving towards normalizing relations. There are two areas. Next to the corridor, these are big areas. At a certain stage, an agreement could be reached with Azerbaijan to transfer five areas because there's no sense in keeping them. They are desolate. People have left. They were basically chased away from these territories. There's no point in keeping them and to have still connection with Nagorno-Karabakh, these two areas would have been sufficient, and we believe that this would be, you know, just, it would be fair to get refugees back, and it would have been a good step towards normalizing the situation in the region as a whole. But the Armenian leadership chose their own path, as, you know, this is what led to the current state of affairs. Now, a question begs itself of how to resolve this issue and how to achieve a peace settlement. We believe, and this is our position, that there is a need for a peace treaty, and we support peaceful resolution, as well as the delimitation of the border and the settlement of all the other border issues. The question is which path to choose. But it is up to Armenia and to the Armenian people and leadership to decide. Whatever option they choose, should it lead to peace, we will support it. But we are not going to impose anything. Nor can we dictate our will to Armenia. We're not going to. If the Armenian people and the current Armenian leadership believe that a certain option is preferable, as far as I understand, it can be the Washington draft, which recognizes Azerbaijan's sovereignty of Nagorno-Karabakh. If Armenia deems that acceptable, well, let it be. We will support any choice the Armenian people makes. If Armenia, the Armenian leadership and the Armenian people believe that Nagorno-Karabakh has certain characteristics, unique ones, that have to be respected, and that this should make its way to the peace treaty, then this option is also on the table. But they need to secure agreement from Azerbaijan. These conditions, these terms have to be acceptable to the other side as well. This is a complex matter. But Armenia is our strategic partner and an ally of ours. And to a large extent, we, of course, have respect for the interests of Azerbaijan, but we will support Armenia's choice. 2 years ago, at this very platform, you spoke very highly about President Erdogan. He said he was not wagging his tail and he was a true man. A lot has happened over the last 2 years. What about this assessment of yours? Is it still in effect? Yes, he is a strong, tough leader. He is guided by the interests of Turkey and the Turkish people and the Turkish economy. And to a large extent, this is what explains his position on energy-related issues, on the construction of TurkStream. We proposed setting up a gas hub in Turkey for consumers in Europe. Turkey has given its assent, of course, also based on their own interests. There are interests in tourism, in construction, in agriculture. We have very many coinciding mutual interests that go in the same direction. And never does President Erdogan give anyone a chance to take advantage of him. But of course, engaging in dialogue with Russia, he also advocates Turkey's interests. Turkey as a whole and President Erdogan are tough negotiators. Many decisions take a lot to come to. They require long discussions, tough negotiations, but we still achieve what we set out to do. And in that sense, President Erdogan is a consistent and reliable partner. This is probably the most important characteristic. He is a reliable partner. Is he not trying to take advantage of you? Well, as I said, he is a tough negotiator. He always takes care of his interests. Well, not his own personal interests, the interests of his country. This does not mean he is trying to take advantage of us. He pursues the interests which he and his government and his advisors believe to be important. We are trying to make sure that the decisions we make suit our purposes as well. And usually we manage to arrive at solutions even to the most difficult of issues in Syria in particular, security-related issues and economic issues, infrastructure-related issues. And up until now, we did manage to arrive at solutions. Let me reiterate. We understand that if the negotiations have been tough, but we managed to arrive at an agreement nonetheless, then it's going to be done. Dayan Çelebi.
My name is Dayan Çelebi, former ambassador of Sri Lanka to the Russian Federation. Mr. President, it is said that Russia is now facing a proxy war waged by the collective West and NATO. If so, it is probably the most serious threat faced by Russia since 1941. At that time, during the Great Patriotic War, the Soviet leader, who was a communist, reached out to the Orthodox Church and to Russian nationalism in order to form a broad front to defend Russia. Would you say that in a similar spirit, you would revisit the Soviet-Russian past, the communist heritage from 1917, to extract any useful elements of it, including the history of the Red Army, And would you think it worthwhile to reach out to the communist elements, however few they are, in Russia, to join in a broad patriotic front? Thank you.
My position consists in the following. I believe we have to take advantage of all of our historical heritage. I believe we should not renounce anything. We should not turn away from the positive elements we used to have in the history of the Russian Empire. There was a lot of positive in the USSR. There were advantages, disadvantages, problems and issues that were overcome in different fashion. They had different consequences. As far as our relationship with the left part of the political spectrum is concerned, as well as other political movements, I can tell you that the special nature of the current Russian society, we have a consensus as far as Russian foreign policy is concerned. Yes, we have pro-Western elements whose families live there, whose children study there. It's a very small component, and every country has such an element. But mostly, our society enjoys a consensus. There is a great level of consolidation, regardless of their political hue, regardless of how they view the path Russia should take in its development. Communists believe that everything should be nationalized once again, that we need to return the state into the economy. Well, how efficient this gonna be? It's hard to tell. To an extent, at a certain stage in history, this probably might happen. We have a law on nationalization, but we are not resorting to it because there is no need for that. We assume that we need to use the most efficient tools for our country's development, mainly the principles of the market, but under the guidance of the authorities and the citizens. We need to use these advantages to achieve such goals as greater well-being for the country, eradication of poverty, taking efforts to build more and better, achieve better health care and education, and address other important issues we are facing. That is why we are working and engaging with those who profess left-wing views. We have respect for them. As you have aptly said, the Soviet Union was controlled by the Communist Party for a very long time. I'm not gonna into detail saying what bad things they were and others. You also mentioned religious organizations. We have four traditional religions in Russia. All of them are vastly patriotic. As far as the Russian Orthodox Church is concerned, throughout all of Russian history, it's been together with its faithful, with its believers, and with its people. And the current stage is no exception. We have some characteristics, special characteristics, right now with regard to our religions. We're not interfering and the internal life of our religions. We probably give them vaster freedoms than some countries that deem themselves to be democratic ones. We believe that we owe our religions a great debt because during the Soviet times their property was taken away from them, sold sometimes. It dealt a heavy blow to religious organizations, in particular to the Russian Orthodox Church. That is why we're trying to support all of our religious groups without, however, interfering in their internal affairs. I think it had never happened before. On the one hand, we sense this general patriotic sentiment. People are patriotic, they want our country to be stronger, our interests abroad be protected. At the same time, we provide full freedom to these organizations, to our citizens. This situation, I think, yields the results we seek. Very well. Kubat Rakimov, please. Kubat Rakimov, Kyrgyzstan. Mr. President, Russia truly is a leader of a new anti-colonial movement across the world. Russia's dedication to traditional conservative values is also resonating. But throughout the history of the Valdai Club, we've seen a great demand for social justice, for a fair organization of social relations. What is your view of this matter, and how can we serve you as experts of the Valdai Club? This is my first question. My second question is as follows. What do you think about the prospect of transferring the capital of Russia eastwards to the center of Russia, to the center of Eurasia, to be closer to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? Thank you. As far as a more just social order is concerned, as per our constitution, Russia is a social state, a social justice state. Everything we do, all our national girls are dedicated to addressing social tasks. We can go hours and hours, and even our today's discussion is not going to be enough to demonstrate fully that everything we do, whatever we do, seeks to address social issues. There are still many issues outstanding, and I said that in the past. We need to develop our economy, and upon this basis we have to address education, healthcare, technological development issues. We have to change the very structure of our economy. Structural changes are most important. This will lead to changes in the labor market, and we have to think about people who are going to be freed up when the market is going to change. We have to retrain them, to give them additional training. As far as the Valdai Club is concerned, it brings together experts of different kinds. And if experts demonstrate to us the trends in key areas, then we would be very grateful to you, because we will take your views into account in building our plans. We will take into account your positions on the trends that we have just spoken about. We need to understand what's going to happen tomorrow to build the policy for today.
As for the transfer of the capital, yes, we've heard such discussions within Russia. There used to be the change of the capital that happened several times throughout the history of the Russian state. Historically, and mentally, Russia has always been associated with Moscow. And I know that there are issues in the development of the capital as a tremendous city, as a megapolis, but I have to say that under the leadership of the current mayor, Mr. Sibanin, has been solved much more efficiently than in other countries of the world and other megapolises. Yes, there are some issues that have to do with transportation and social infrastructure development. Still, over the past years, Mayor Sibanin has done a lot for these issues to be curbed and to create the necessary conditions for the citizens of Moscow and everyone who comes over here to Moscow to work there or as a tourist, for them to feel comfortably in the capital. A lot has been done for the development of the city in the past years. The issue of over-centralization of all federal institutions in Moscow is indeed there. Just like in some other countries, for example, I'm an advocate of the solution, just like in other countries. What they've done is they've decentralized, and they have transferred mandate and competences of the capital to other regions of the country. For example, we're creating a judicial center in St. Petersburg. The constitutional court has been transferred to St. Petersburg. We have specific plans for the Supreme Court. Well, it needs to be done without haste to create the ripe conditions for the judicial community to work in St. Petersburg. It will be done without fuss, without haste. Some major companies, for example, which work in Siberia, for example, but their management is situated in Moscow. They could have placed their headquarters in Siberia. And that happens. For example, Rushydro. They've created their base in Krasnoyarsk, I believe. They're creating their HQ there, as well as some of this central authorities could be more decentralized around the territory of Russia. That will benefit the governance system and the regions where they will be situated. Thank you. Ivan Timofeev. Good evening, Mr. President. Ivan Timofeev, Valdai Club. My question is the following. Russia has experienced a tremendous amount of sanctions against it. You've mentioned the freezing of our assets of 300 billion. We can add dozens of billions of the property of our citizens and our organizations. They're planning to confiscate these assets, and they're developing the necessary mechanism. Also, financial limitations, bans on supplying technologies and goods to Russia, Russian oil supply banned, and manipulation of everything. You know, we know it full well. You've mentioned it in your statement. Our economy was not expected to survive that, but it did. To a large extent, it was done because the economy remains a market-based economy. It adjusts. Business is looking for new target markets. Where possible, it tries to substitute imports. The government is taking a number of steps to support entrepreneurs. However, considering the extreme external conditions and sanctions, maybe the time has come to further deregulate the economy. You mentioned decentralization, for example, to cut down on the number of inspections and to decrease the regulatory burden. Well, this is our choice to cut down on the number of inspections, well, to get rid of over-regulation coming from the state. You know that the routine inspections have been scraped, not only for SMEs, but for major businesses as well, and will, if it hasn't been said before, will continue the same conditions for 2023 as well. As for regulations, this regulatory guillotine that we've spoken about, I think it led to more than 1,000 legislative acts have been repealed and substituted with less than 500 new ones. I hope they've been updated. I think it's 400 and something. New regulation acts that regulate the economic activity. Will continue down this path. Naturally, with the exceptions to those types of production that have to do with certain risks for the consumer. I think it's quite apparent to everyone. Still, even here, we'll try to make it so that all these regulatory functions and inspections would be targeted and will not stand in the way of the work of business on the whole and certain businesses. Well, you're quite right that as a response to all kind of limitations introduced against Russia and against its economy, you said that the economy was meant to come to be brought down. Well, it wasn't supposed to. That was the very goal. but that did not happen. Indeed, the economy became more resilient, more adjusting. It turns out that our entrepreneurial community is rather mature and is capable of taking over those spheres and those businesses that have been left by some of the partners. It was done very easily. Our businesses take over the productions that seemingly could not live without the Western presence, almost in all spheres. Yes, we see some issues in midterm perspective. We understand that we cannot produce everything. In the morning, I spoke to some of the colleagues before I traveled here. It's clear that I've been talking to everyone in the government, in the central bank, in the administration. Our experts believe that the acme of hardships that had to do with this influx of sanctions and limitations is over. Russian economy has, in general, adjusted to the new normal. A lot will have to be done for the new chains of supply in import and export to be created to cut down the costs that have to do with that. But in general, we've been through the worst of it. The Russian economy has adapted and will continue to develop more sustainably and more with greater sovereignty. However, the response to all these challenges should be, first and foremost, I believe, de-bureaucratization, getting rid of red tape to support businesses, and increasing the field of freedom for economic activity. Okay, Alexander, we cannot do without you. Mr. President, quite often the foreigners ask us what Russia can offer to the new world. Where are your Nobel Prize winners? Where are your great discoveries, industrial and scientific discoveries? Well, my colleagues are saying, well, what about the great Russian culture? Rublev, icons, Pushkin, great Russian architecture. Well, it's all the thing of the past. What about today? When I was listening to you today, I finally understood what Russia could offer to the modern world. It can offer the religion of justice. I think that this feeling lies in the foundation of our Russian culture, of our capability to sacrifice. Russia is alone against the cruel Western world, is fighting for justice. That is a tremendous input of today's Russia into global civilization and culture, because those previous traditional values that we've been discussing, for example, Rublev, Andrei Rublev, Russian icon painter, wonderful Novgorod architecture, the golden and the silver age of architecture, they all spoke about equity and equality and justice. That is the core of the Russian civilization. Should we make the Russian ideology today is the religion of justice? We have four traditional Russian religions, and I think that's quite enough. Well, it's a joke, of course. As for doing something, well, you know, I keep track of your work, and I'm always happy to read what you're writing. I know that you're a true Russian patriot in the widest sense of that word, in the best sense of the word. Do we need to present to someone these ideas specifically? Well, I don't know if it's necessary. You've just said that we're sacrificing something in the interests of other nations. I think I can argue with you here that we're not sacrificing anything. Well, we're working to strengthen our sovereignty. It is in our interests. Primarily, that is reinforcement of our financial and economic sovereignty. And that would underpin and be the foundation for our future development in technology, education, and science. Whether we have Nobel Prize winners or not, well, Alferov made his, when did he make his mention? 30, and only 30 years later he received his Nobel Prize. Well, the ex-president of the U.S. received a Nobel Peace Prize. Well, does it mean that it was an achievement? With all due respect to the Nobel Committee and to those who received, have been awarded this Nobel Prize, well, that's not the only metric. Our science is developing, and we need to do everything so that the yield from the fundamental and applied sciences would be a lot higher for our development. And we will do that. What's happening today is we have great rejuvenation of scientific talent. Our scientists are one of the youngest in the world. Yes, well, the U.S., they have their competitive advantages considering that they have the monopoly for international finances. They suck everything out, including scientific and creative talent. But that will be over when they lose their domination with the dollar as the main currency. That's happening already. It's already underway. So what we are doing is very attractive for many countries and nations in the world. The Western partners are doing everything possible to smear Russia, to ignore its interests. So when we are fighting and standing up for our interests, and we do that openly, transparently, and courageously, let's be honest here, the very fact of that example, well, it's very infectious for and attractive for billions of people around the world. Take many countries in Africa. They have Russian flags. Right now, they fly Russian flags. In Latin America, the same is happening. In Asia, we have a lot of friends. And we don't have to impose anything on anyone. It's just that many people and political figures and just regular citizens, they're tired of living under external dictate. They're done with that. So when we see our example of fighting against this dictate, they're both inside and externally with us. They're supporting us, and that support will only increase. Thank you. We spoke a lot about science this time. I think it was one of the most interesting sessions of the Valdai Club, how to develop science and technology in these conditions. So I'd like to give the floor to Ruslan Yunusov. He painted a very interesting picture for us. Thank you. Today, I represent Rosatom and the Valdai Club. Indeed, you spoke about science and you said the right words about it. We've seen that over the past 20 years, support for science has increased manifold. Megagrant program has allowed to launch a great number of modern labs in Russia. But we, as scientists, we see that the majority of professors who opened these labs did not travel to Russia and do not reside there permanently. And it's easy to understand why it's hard to compete. You have a tenured position, for example, in the U.S. or somewhere in the West, or you have just a grant for 5 years in Russia. We've discussed it that Chinese colleagues indeed has made a tremendous breakthrough in science. And today they didn't just bring back their scientists, but they are number one in many dimensions. And we're going to quantum, and we know that China right now has the most powerful quantum computer, and the same applies to other quantum computations. Still, in Russia, we have other programs that unite together many labs. For example, this quantum computer program, 20 study groups, 15 institutions, and Academy of Science. but we have a horizon of planning of 5 years. Today, we've come across greater pressure. It's indeed our scientific challenge to our sovereignty. Maybe that's the right time to start and to draft projects for 10 or 20 years ahead. Thank you. Of course, the longer the horizon, the better. I agree with you. We need to look at the positive experience of other countries or our friends and partners, including the People's Republic of China. They have done a lot over the past years under the leadership of President Xi. He dedicates great attention to that. Well, not only to the development of science, but of China on the whole and Chinese economy, on improving the living standards of the people of China. I know that very well. We have good friendly relations with him. And we need to take a look at where they have practical results. We should study that and introduce that into our reality. As for mega grants, indeed they have played a positive role. And the next stage that we're implementing right now is not just research or creating specific labs, but we're talking about creating scientific communities of young scientists. That is the future of this mega grant program. I agree with those who have initiated the process. We're working that, right, Andre? We'll continue to do that. You said that no one traveled, and well, some did, if they formally are abroad, but still they spend most of their time in Russia. These are our former compatriots, well, compatriots in general. They often travel to work in Russia. You know, the world of science as well as the world of art does not tolerate artificial limitations and borders. People should feel free. We're not going to lock anyone down here, but we'll welcome everyone who would like to go to Russia. And generally, we succeed. Well, maybe indeed we should increase the horizon for our planning. We have a five-year-long mega grant, right? Maybe we should extend them. I think that these matters have to do with budget financing, but I think it can be done. Today, we could expand the horizon. So what you've said about that the person is working somewhere, has some kind of a professor tenured, and it's for life, and well, that doesn't apply everywhere. Well, you're the scientist. You know that sometimes there are contracts signed for several years, and after that, bye-bye. Well, it's not for life. Well, at least not everywhere.
But living in the area of your culture, of your language, it's for life, and this freedom has to be given to those who work in culture and science, scholars. We have to set in place conditions that are going to be more attractive than the ones offered abroad. It's not going to be easy, but this is the path we are following, and we will share results, and we would probably extend the horizon of planning. One way, please.
I'm a professor from Chongyang Institute, Lenmin University of China. Actually, this time I visited Russia more than 20 cities, and I wrote a lot of articles to tell Chinese people a real Russia, because in China there are a lot of people, they care about Russia, and especially care about you, your safety, and so my question is that, because I know you maybe will have a lot of pressure and a burden, and do you feel scared or nervous or anxiety, especially under the threat from the West? And so did you create a new Russia, or Russia destiny create you? So so I think that the second question is that what do you want to say to Chinese people, and what's your comments on the past 10 years, Russia and China relationship, and what's your predictions and expectations on the future of Russia and China relationship? Thank you so much.
You know, when I work, I never think about any historic achievements. I think what I need to do and what I cannot do without. This is the most important thing. And in that sense, the circumstances, the country you end up in, they make a contribution to forming the personality of a human being, and I myself am no exception to that. Well, as far as fear goes, many would probably love to hear me say that I'm scared, but if I were scared, I would never have done anything. And I cannot be guided by such motives. Given the position I hold, I need to be guided only by the interests of the Russian citizens, the Russian state. And this is what I'm doing, and something I'm going to continue to do. I'm going to do what I think to be right for the benefit of my country and my people. As far as the Russian-Chinese relations go, over the last year, over the last decade, they have been propelled to a whole new level of openness, mutual trust, and efficiency. Country-wise, China is our biggest trade partner. We are working together in almost all, if not all, areas. In the military field in particular, we hold joint exercises all the time. In military and technical field, we have relations based on trust. Probably this is unparalleled as far as the history of our countries goes. We work in culture and in the humanitarian field. And of course, in the economy, the biggest trade Russia has is with China, and it's growing at an enormous pace. And this pace we achieved even before all kinds of limitations. And before we had to redistribute our trade flows towards Asian countries, in China in particular. My friend, and here calls me a friend as well, and I think him to be my friend, President Xi, we have decided to achieve a certain level of bilateral trade, and we are moving towards that at a higher pace than we planned, than we anticipated. As far as our relation an attitude towards China goes, we think of the Chinese nation, of the Chinese people, as a friend, an ally. We have great respect for your traditions, for your history. And I'm confident that based upon this solid foundation, we are going to forge ahead with confidence. As far as fears go, Professor Wang has said, this year, since spring, the nuclear topic popped up, and you spoke about that, and many people got nervous because they remembered what you used to say at the Valdai Forum 4 years prior, that we would get to the paradise, all of us. But we're in no haste to get there, right? You were giving it some thought, and it makes me nervous. Well, I did it on purpose to make you anxious. Well, mission accomplished. Thank you. Mohammed Iksan, please.
From Kurdistan region of Iraq. I'm so glad to be here, Mr. President, really. I have one direct question for you. At the topic of the session is post-hegemonic war, justice and security for everybody. Do you think at this stage, Kurds in four parts of Kurdistan, they are going to have more, better security and more justice for the future, if you don't mind to elaborate more? And as you mentioned that in Central America and in Africa, Russian flag is everywhere. You have people who loves and who support Russia. be sure also in Middle East you have a lot of supporters and a lot of lovers for Russia and mainly for President Putin. Thank you.
Спасибо.
Thank you. For the last part of what you said, especially. Yes, flags are also flying in European countries and in the US as well. We've got many supporters over there. And in the US, there is a big chunk of population who stick to traditional values and they're together with us. As far as Kurds go, I said that on multiple occasions, not just about Kurds, the Kurdish people, but also all peoples. We need to strike a balance of interests. Only if a balance of interests is achieved will the world be stable, and the same goes for the future of the Russian and the Kurdish people. Thank you. Let's move on. I think Mrs. Sarish is over there. Thank you. Good evening. Konstantin Starish, the Republic of Moldova. I represent the parliamentary opposition, of course, opposition, because our leadership to our bane and the bane of our nation so far seems to prefer other destinations for its foreign voyages, and as a result, Kishinev is almost in complete blackout. There's no light. So I have a question, but I also have a charge I have to perform. I've got two children, 8 and 10 years. They live in Kishinev and study at the Pushkin Lyceum, and they wanted to ask me to give you their best. So greetings from Alexandra and from Gavrila, who live in Kishinev. And now on to the question. You spoke about the inevitability of the emergence of new models for engagement between different countries and regions. In that context, maybe it would be worthwhile getting back to the idea you voiced back in 2001 about one single humanitarian social space that would extend from Vladivostok to Lisbon. For us Moldovans of different ethnic origins, it would be very good indeed, because it's very hard for us to choose between Europe and Russia, and for us, between the good and another good, it would be very promising for us. It would be the light at the end of the tunnel. But is it possible in a world we're about to build, a world after conflicts, a world where there is going to be no hegemon, no global policeman, no dominating power? Is such a space possible? Humanitarian space, economic space, security space, to ensure the safety of all those who live in this vast expanse from Vladivostok to Lisbon? Yes, that is possible, because hope persists until the very end. And, you know, it was not our idea. It was first an idea of a common space to the Ural, and I transformed this idea of our French counterparts, because, you know, the very same culture exists beyond the Ural Mountains. Right now, the world is seeing these tragic events, very difficult tribulations. But why not? In general, yes, it is possible to imagine, to conceive of. And I think that this way or another, this is going to happen. Because as I pointed out, I spoke about Eurasia as a whole in my address. And I referred to the European part of Eurasia as well. But let me get back to what I said in my address. It's important for this European part of Eurasia to get its autonomy back. It's impossible to talk to your partner if they cannot decide anything and they have to get back to Washington on every little issue to ask their permission to do this, to do that. but this is what happens. I remember those difficult events around Syria when all of it started. One of the leaders came to me. We had a meeting. We agreed what we were going to do and how we were going to do in detail. And then this leader came to Washington from us. And then he gets back to Paris, and it's all forgotten, as if there had been no agreement with us whatsoever. But there were some agreements, concrete ones too, where we were going to move the fleet, the navy, and we had no objections. We agreed on everything. It's impossible to talk, and there's no point in talking. It's better to give a direct call to Washington instead. I'm not making this up. Of course, Europe protects its interests in economy in particular, but even that, not that well. You know, the gas pipelines were blown up, not ours. There are 5 European companies in Nord Stream 1, and all are keeping mum as if everything were going according to plan. And they have the audacity to point the finger at us, saying that Russia was the one to have blown its own gas pipelines. But it's absurd. I think Gazprom has published the photos of 2016. There was an explosive device, American produced probably, that was next to the gas pipeline. They said they had lost it during some military exercises, and lost it in such a way that it turned out to be directly under a gas pipeline. And this explosive device was meant, I think, to eliminate undersea mines. There are photos demonstrating that. And the world media are not broadcasting that. No one is trying to disseminate this information. You cannot find it anywhere, neither in the media nor elsewhere. They use their monopoly promoting the information that suits them and killing off any information that they're not happy with. And that's why everyone is keeping silent. Yes, we need to build this single space in all aspects, from Lisbon to Vladivostok, but you can only do that working together with those who have a voice of their own. I'm not trying to provoke anyone. I'm not going to give any insult to anyone, but this is the real life of today. But historically, I think this is possible. I said that, but let me reiterate it. Helmut Kohl once told me that the U.S. would turn to its own affairs in Latin America. He said Asia would develop strongly following its own path. He said if European civilization wants to preserve itself as a world center, then it has to be together with Russia. This is the position Helmut Kohl espoused. Right now, the current leadership of Germany probably has different views. But it's up to European countries to decide. But I would like to get back to what you started with. You said there was a blackout. We do not understand why this happened. We have nothing to do with that whatsoever. But why am I saying this? Everyone is always laying the blame for everything on Russia. If the lights go out in somewhere or something else happens, Russia is always to blame. You know, this movie, a chapel of the 12th century. Are we the ones to have destroyed it as well, as the famous movie says? But I would like to inform you. And what I'm going to tell you is truth and nothing but the truth. When we were engaged in talks with the Moldovan government on gas supplies, on gas prices, Gazprom decided to choose a fully pragmatic position, a market-based position, in negotiating a contract with Moldova on gas supplies. Moldova did not agree with Gazprom's position. it was insisting on gas price preferences. Gazprom was persevering in its position. Then Mr. Miller came to me. He explained his position to me. He said that his position was the right one. I asked him to accommodate the Moldovan requests, taking into account the financial and the economic capabilities of Moldova. I said, yes, maybe this price might be, you know, fair from the market point of view, but it's impossible to sustain. He did not fully agree, but he listened to me, and Gazprom decided to accommodate the government of Moldova, and a contract was entered into based on Moldovan terms, the terms proposed by the Moldovan government. There are many details. I do not want to bore you with those because it's not that interesting. It is related to the current payments, to debts, to some prepayments. But as far as the price parameters go, we fully accommodated Moldova. And of course, payments have to be made. I think it's only logical. So why did it come to this when there's no electricity? I don't know why. Mr. President, you remembered Europe. A couple of months ago, there was a very interesting case. You spoke to President Macron sometime before the launch of the military operation, and it turned out that a journalist was sitting in his office, and you know, he was on speaker, and journalists took down every word that was spoken. What do you think about that? Well, I have a negative view of that. I think there are certain formats for interaction between leaders of countries, and these formats have to be adhered to, otherwise the trust will disappear. In general, this, well, nothing bad if what we are talking about, if, you know, our assessments make their way to journalists. But you have to warn about that. And you were not warned. No, I was not. Especially if it's a telephone conversation via a closed line, we always assume that these talks are confidential and they're not subject to publication. And whatever is published, it should be agreed upon by the two parties. And when President Macron calls you, do ask him if there is anyone in the room with him. Well, I assume that someone is listening on. I see. And the first row, our guest from Indonesia.
Thank you. Mr. President, I like your speech so much because I think your speech really bring the spirit of building together, building stronger, something like that, like the tagline for the G20. So we are looking forward to your visit at G20 next month. What I'm going to ask you is about the title. The title today is Post-Hegemonic World, Justice and Security to Everyone. I wonder because President Sukarno, our president, in 1955, already said that all these security alliances is dangerous to the world. You are in Security Council, China in Security Council. Do you think you and China can just file this issue of, you know, wipe out NATO, AUKUS, the Quad, of five power defense arrangement, everything about it together? Is that possible? Number two, your fans in Indonesia is amazing. Everybody said URA all the time. So my second question is, can I have a picture with you later? Thank you.
Yes, with great pleasure, with such a beautiful woman, naturally. We have very good relations with Indonesia throughout the modern history, I have to say. And President Widodo, when he calls me, he talks to me and he addresses me as a brother, and I reciprocate. And we cherish the relation that we have with Indonesia. I'm thankful to the leadership and to the president for his invitation to G20. We will think on the way that we will be represented. We'll be represented at high level. Maybe I will travel, but I'll think about it. As for the creation of new blocs in Asia, I think that's an attempt to transfer to Asia the system of bloc thinking that has failed in the Atlantic region, and it is a nefarious idea. It is yet another attempt to be friends against someone, and in this case, to be friends against China. We not only do not support this attempt to resuscitate or reconstruct what was happening in the Atlantic, in the Asia-Pacific region, but we also believe that this is a very detrimental and dangerous endeavor. I have to say that it has grave ramifications for participants or for allies of the United States themselves. As we know, some submarines contracts have been taken away from them and so on. Well, nothing is done yet, but the negative consequences for the U.S. allies are already in place. If such practice continues, the number of these blunders will only increase. Naturally, we have always been against such policies. General Sharma wanted to ask a question. I know that. But first, please wait for the mic.
In a post-hegemonic world, what role you expect India to play?
India has made a tremendous progress in its development. From being a British colony to its modern state, almost 1.5 billion people, tangible development results. That gives reasons to everyone's respect and admiration for India. A lot has been done in the past years under the leadership of Prime Minister Modi. Naturally, he's a patriot of his country. And his idea of make in India, it matters, both in economic-wise and in the ethic. So India has made tremendous steps forward in development, and the future belongs to India. It can be proud of the fact that it's the largest democracy in the world. It can also be proud of its development momentum. This is a very important foundation that India is building on. We have a special relationship with India. It is being underpinned by a very close ally relationship over many decades. We've never had any difficult issues. We've always supported each other. And that is happening right now, and I'm sure this will be the case in the future as well. Right now, economic cooperation is increasing. Prime Minister Modi has asked me to, well, just to give you an example, we have increased trade volumes. As an example, Prime Minister Modi has asked me to increase supply of fertilizers, and that is very important for Indian agriculture, and we've done that. Do you know how much we've increased the volume? 7.6 times. That's the increase, not just some percentage, but 7.6 times. So almost trade in agriculture has almost doubled. We have continued relationship in military and technical cooperation. Prime Minister Modi is one of those people in the world who is capable of conducting an independent foreign policy in the interests of it, of its nation, despite any attempts to do some detente or to limit something. He's like an icebreaker moving in the necessary direction for the Indian people. And I'm sure that India has a great future and an increasing role in the global affairs. Since we are talking about fertilizers, I'm thinking back to Brazil right away. Where is Igor Gilov? He's over there. Well, by the way, we've agreed with Brazil that fertilizer supply will increase. Unfortunately, it went down. I don't know why it's happening, maybe because of logistics. I think it has decreased by several percent. I think he's left the audience. Then I'll ask you the question that I know he wanted to ask. I think the elections are looming in Brazil. So what do you think? Lula is coming back. Are you in good relationship with him? Yes, we have good relationship with Mr. Lula, with Mr. Bolsonaro. We're not interfering in the domestic processes. That's the most important thing. That we know that in India, despite even difficulties, there is consensus about our cooperation in BRICS and in other formats as well. It's of principled importance for us. We also have a consensus regarding cooperation with Brazil. We believe Brazil is one of our most important partners in Latin America. That's the way it is, and we'll do everything in our power to develop them further. Well, since we started on the BRICS topic, there was an initiative pitched, I think, about 2 weeks ago that Saudi Arabia wants to join it. Do you support it? Yes, we support it. For that, we need the consensus of all BRICS countries. But Saudi Arabia is a rapidly developing country. It has to do not only with the fact that it's a leader in hydrocarbon production and oil production. It has to do with the fact that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has tremendous plans on diversification of the economy. It's very important. He has a tremendous national development plan dedicated to that. And I'm positive. I know that they use their energy, vibrance of Crown Prince will translate into reality. And of course, Saudi Arabia is worthy of being a member of major international associations like BRICS or Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We've recently defined the status of Saudi Arabia in the SCO, and we'll develop our relation with that country, both bilaterally and multilaterally. Right now, in the West, a lot is being written due to the about that Ben Salman is being cheeky with Americans because of you. Well, that's not true. Bin Salman is a decisive young person. He has character. It's apparent. He doesn't need to, well, someone doesn't need to be cheeky with him. Then you won't hear some harsh evaluations coming from national interests. And if we're talking about decreasing or increasing production, and I know Crown Prince personally very well, I know what kind of ideas he's following nationally. He's following the national interests, and he wants to balance out the energy markets. And in that sense, and there is no irony here, his position is very well balanced. It wants to strike a balance between the producers and the consumers on the market, because the energy markets are not about the pricing, the end pricing. That's not the most important thing. That's just the current political or economic climate. But for the international energy market, the most important thing is predictability and stability. That's what matters. And Crown Prince strives for that, and in general, he achieves what he wants. So you cannot take advantage of him as well. No, for sure not.
Thank you very much. I'm bringing a lot of respect and love from Islamabad, Pakistan. Director General of Pakistan House, Muhammad Athar Javed. You see, I really appreciate your comprehensive and very incisive analysis of the situation. My question relates to a very important, it relates to also the pre-Second World War, where Jews were demonized and then later ignored the plight, their everything relates to them were ignored by the Western Europe and United States. And in the end, a horrible Holocaust took place. Now there is a hate syndrome generated about Russians. You mentioned about Denebasa, how the people were being treated. And I have witnessed myself in United Kingdom, in Scandinavian countries, there is a rise of neo-Nazism. And particularly, myself personally working on the project on this to assess the patterns. And what we are realizing that it is actually serious. Number one, it's not being reported like the previous instances in the pre-Second World War. Number two, it's being like, I would say, like wash it away, washing away totally. That means there is a need on the part of Russia to protect, as you said, the Russian language issue with the Russians outside Europe, outside Russia, and also to try to implement a counter design against the new Nazis, rise of new Nazis. It's a very serious threat. And the last component of this is, in Ukraine, is a recruitment of non-state actors from across different regions are being reported, very credible reports, in order to initiate a full non-state actors brigade against to fight the conventional army to weaken the resolve. I think these needs to be addressed. I'd really like you to give your analysis because this is very serious. Europe is facing rise of neo-Nazism. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that one of the most serious and fundamental issues of those who allegedly care about the future of Ukraine, of the so-called Ukrainian nationalist, is in the fact that there is a connection, a nexus between the neo-Nazi and neo-fascist movement. Because they are not those who can be called collaborationists or Nazis. They cannot be characterized as those who, upon task of the Nazi authorities, eliminated Jews, Russians, Poles, and others on the occupied territories during the Second World War. You cannot distinguish between today's jingo, patriot, and nationalist and Bandera followers. They are basically the same thing. And I think that's their tremendous issue. So when I spoke with our Western so-called partners, and I was telling them, look at what is happening in the streets of Kiev and other major cities, when there are swastikas being flaunted around by thousands of people, torch marches, and so on. Yes, we might have some manifestations as well. This is a very infectious disease in other countries as well, but we're fighting against it, but they support that at the national level. This is an issue. It's being disregarded and kept silent, but it exists. And the jingo patriots in the Ukraine are not being moved by this or the ideas of nationalism. It's much more primitive. They're following an economic interest. They want to preserve billions of dollars in the Western banks that they've stolen from the Ukrainian nation. They stole it, they hid it away in European banks, and to ensure the security and safety of their assets, they do everything that the West tells them to do. Putting that in the shape of nationalism and presenting it to its own nation as a fight for the interests of the Ukrainian nation, that is what's happening in reality. They spare not a single Ukrainian. They're a fight against Russians. There are losses, and, you know, I'm talking about that knowingly, and I say that with regret. Sometimes losses are one, the ratio is 1 to 8 or 1 to 10, mostly 1 to 7 or 1 to 8 recently. They don't spare people. Whether real patriots of their country would allow that. But they're walking down this path with no regrets, not even thinking twice. Of course, they're not protecting their national interests. But this disease of nationalism is a living thing. But the fact that they're trying to disregard that this is neo-Nazism, that's a major issue for the Ukrainian regime and for those who are supporting them. But we cannot help but pay attention to it, and we'll always point it out. Also one of the preconditions for the current crisis. Mr. Kim?
From South Korea. It's my second time to join the Baldai Club, and I learned a lot, and I thank you very much for providing the chances to think many things. And I have some questions about the first one is about the security. So I'd like to know your opinion or Russia's position on growing tensions actually between China and the United States over Taiwan, and North Korea's nuclear and missile development. And another question is about the combat against the climate change. Russia is very rich in the fossil natural resources. And so too speedy, transformation of the carbon neutral might contradict Russia's interest. What do you think about that? Thank you.
Let me pick up the last part of your question. Transitioning to carbon neutrality does not contradict Russian interests, because we have other options, such as the production of hydrogen, in particular clean hydrogen, and we enjoy a significant competitive edge in this field. We can use natural gas for the production of such hydrogen, so we're not scared by this transition in the least. On the contrary, it creates additional incentives for our development. As far as the transition energy source is concerned, natural gas is the best source of energy. Speaking about deep processing of oil, here too, we enjoy competitive advantages I've just spoken about. So it's not in conflict with our interests. The only thing in conflict with our interests is a chaos in the energy sector. Trying to get ahead of yourself in addressing such issues as green energy or energy security. For many years, there's been an underfunding or even hampering of investment into traditional sources of energy. And all the while, green energy was not yet ready to take on the bulk. So this mismatch is the foundation of the current energy crisis. The Western politicians are simply talking the talk, trying to scare their voters about the climate change. Then they get in power and they do not do anything they promised. And what we see is that they're getting back to using fuel oil or coal to produce energy. Yes, they did talk, beautiful talk, but we see the result. And it's not Russia that is to blame. We are willing to provide our gas. Why refuse it? Even after the pipelines have been blown up, still we have one string that can be used. Several hundred thousands of cubic meters can be pumped through this remaining pipeline, but they do not want that. Systemic measures aimed at curbing the development of traditional energy sources have resulted in the current energy crisis. There is no funding, banks provide no loans, and not just in Europe, but also in the U.S., banks are reluctant to provide loans. There is no insurance. No land is being allocated for that, for pipelines in particular, and for the transportation. And it's been going on like this for years, a significant underfunding of traditional sources of energy. Hence the result. Yes, the U.S. is allocating some of its oil reserves for the current purposes, but sooner or later they will have to be replenished, and experts understand that. Today they are taken out of their strategic reserves. Tomorrow they will have to replenish them to supply. They say that they are going to replenish them once the prices go down, but so far they stay very high. So, willy-nilly they will have to buy at high prices. And we've got nothing to do that. To blame for that are the systemic errors committed by those who were supposed to care for this sector. Now, as for North Korea and Taiwan, Taiwan indubitably is an inherent part of the People's Republic of China, and this is the position we've always adhered to. It remains unchanged. All provocative gestures, such as the visits to Taiwan by the U.S. highest dignitaries, are seen in Russia as nothing but a provocation. Why do that? Honestly, I cannot answer that. You know, I've known many of you for many years, and we speak the same language. But let's speak as if we're one family, in plain terms. You see this strategy in Ukraine. The whole West has pounced on us, trying to bring down our economy, funneling millions of dollars in arms in Ukraine fighting Russia. So why sour their relations with China at the same time? Are they mad or what? It's against all common sense. Why did that old woman have to go to Taiwan, provoking China to respond, all while being unable to resolve the issue around Ukraine and Russia? It's absurd. Some might think that, you know, there's some calculation, but I think it was not calculated at all. All there is to it is arrogance and also sense of impunity. This is what underlies such irrational actions. Our position is clear. I've already expressed it. Now let me turn to nuclear issue of the DPRK. I think this issue is also due to the reluctance to talk, due to such blatant disregard of the DPRK's interests. You know, at a certain point in time, the agreement was all but reached, and the North Korean leadership was basically given its agreement to the proposals put forth by the U.S. on resolving this matter, and in particular the nuclear component. But at the 11th hour, the U.S. revisited its position, making the DPRK pull back from the agreement that had been achieved, and the U.S. had to slap additional sanctions and additional restrictions in finance, even though an agreement had been reached before that not to do that. So what's the point? Incidentally, China and we have joint proposals as to how we should go about resolving this matter. These proposals have been formulated into documents that we have put forth. Everyone is well aware of that, and we will stick to this jointly agreed position. By the by, as far as the humanitarian issues go and related matters, we need to understand the current state of affairs. The DPRK economy is in the needs of its rank and file citizens, and we should not, you know, drive too hard because there are humanitarian concerns to think about. We have very good relations with the Republic of Korea, and we always enjoyed the benefit of having dialogue both with the DPRK and with the Republic of Korea. Right now, we know that the Republic of Korea has decided to supply weapons and arms to Ukraine. This is going to destroy our relations. What would Republic of Korea think if we resumed our military cooperation with the DPRK? Would you be happy? I would like you to think about that. Mr. President, since you have said that it's, you know, a family gathering, you know, through Poland. Yes, you said that it's kind of a family affair. So could you please reveal to the family something? There was a lot of speculation, you know. In February, you were in China. You met with President Xi. Did you warn him of your plans? No, I did not. You know, didn't he later said he was offended by that? Well, you know, the leader of China does not express any offenses like that. He is his own person, and we do not need to inform anyone because we are a sovereign country, just like the People's Republic of China. China sees full well how important an issue it is to Russia that NATO is trying to move its military infrastructure closer to its borders. China has seen what's been happening in the Donbas for the last 8 years, and China is fully capable of assessing the causes and the consequences of the coup d'etat that occurred in Ukraine in 2014. Of course, China and its leadership are championing well-balanced, pragmatic solutions. They are in favor of a peaceful resolution of the current Ukrainian crisis, and we fully respect that. Well, then, Nelson Wong, please. Yes, is over there.
Thank you. I'm Nelson Wong from Shanghai, China. It's a real honor, Mr. President. In your remarks, you mentioned that the rule-based order that was often used and that is still being used by the West, they come from nowhere, which is actually quite true, and this is also discussed quite frequently over the past 4 days in our discussions. So my question to you, Mr. President, is that looking forward, we are actually moving into a time without superpower, which was the topic of the first day of this year's discussion. So since the U.S., as the only superpower, is losing its control, and we're moving into a new era, this is not only the beginning of the end of the U.S. superpower, but already we are in the process. So, in a new phase, I believe we also need to have some rules. So if we are ever going to have any rules, what, in your opinion, Mr. President, are the most important? Of course, it's not there yet, but for argument's sake, what would you think would be the most important when it comes to setting up a new set of rules. Thank you.
Well, such rules already exist, and they are enshrined in the UN Charter. And these rules are called international law. The only thing left to do is for everyone to stick to these rules and to give them one and the same interpretation. Renouncing these rules or modernizing those rules, overhauling them, well, it's only possible once we have prepared the necessary foundation for our relations based upon some other principles. The UN Charter enshrined the balance of powers attained after the Second World War. Of course, since then, the world has evolved drastically. It's changed. We have such new giants as China, India, Indonesia, with a very big population. There are many big countries in Africa, countries with a population of more than 200 million people. And there are also big countries in Latin America. Accordingly, international legal norms have to follow these changes, and the relationships between countries should be regulated based upon the balance of power we see in reality. But this has to be a cautious, prudent, calm process based upon clear-cut principles, not just rules someone has come up with. I said that during my address. Who wrote and read those rules? They're talking about them, but they have never been written down nor agreed upon. Is it meant for some imbeciles? Maybe it's meant for those who do not know how to read. I don't know. What are these rules? Who has ever seen these rules? It's just absurd. But, you know, as they say, they are constantly insisting on them and say that if someone breaks these rules, then sanctions will be introduced. They are engaged in a trade war with China because of that. They're saying that China should do this and that in certain provinces of China, sticking to human rights and all that. These are tools to fight China. And these are tools of bad faith competition too. They're afraid of China's growing might. Hence, all these attempts at using human rights as a weapon, trying to criticize what's happening in certain areas of China, all of that trying to pursue their own short-term economic interests. This is the only explanation they are trying to fight China as a growing rival. What should underlie our relations is respect for the interests of one another, openness, and as a common rule, legal norms that should be interpreted and applied by all members of the international community in the uniform fashion. We need to strike this balance of interests. We have to rebuild it, and then we should stick to these norms. But I think this has to be done publicly, not just behind closed doors, nor should it suit just the interests of one group of country. It should be in the interests of humankind as a whole. President Putin, let's stick to China and also get back to green energy. Understandably, the European energy market is going to be close to us in the next several years, probably going to be close to us completely. It's possible. Are we ready to build an infrastructure for Asian markets rapidly? Well, you know what we did not based on short-term fluctuations. You know, the power of Siberia was not built due to the developments in Ukraine. The power of Siberia was constructed because we understood full well that the needs of our friends in China in energy were growing, and we had a chance to satisfy those needs. We are engaged in talks with India about different modes of supplying our energy resources to India. We're also going to talk to other countries. We're also going to talk about LNG. You know, our share in the world LNG market so far is quite modest, but growing nonetheless, and we're going to keep at it. And let me say that what we're doing is not due to the current developments. These are just general trends. In PPP terms, the economy of China is bigger than the U.S. economy. It's a fact. And the needs of China are growing. Moreover, they are our friends and neighbors. We've got great relations with them. We have a common border with China. So why not supply energy resources to them? And the same goes for other Asian countries. We did that, and we are going to continue to do that. We have just agreed on a new system via Mongolia. Mongolia is interested, just as China is. We are going to allow our friends and partners to our mining capacities, as we used to do with Europeans and Americans. If they want to pull out from our market, let them. There are others who will take their place. Whether that's good for them, well, I think it's bad for them. They are pulling out from our market, suffering losses, but whoever wants to enter our market, we welcome them. We're open to cooperation, and this process is going to continue. Are we ready for that? Yes, we've been ready for many years, and this process will continue. I see no barrier we cannot overcome. There's no issue we cannot resolve. Colleagues, there in the back, there are two hands. Yes. Alexei Dermant, Minsk, Belarus. Before I ask my question, Mr. President, I would like to give the words of support to you from many Belarusians. I meet with them on many discussion platforms. We discuss Ukraine in particular and the current developments. To you and to Russia, who is fighting Nazism in Ukraine, I would like to express my ardent support. My question is as follows. The West is basically erecting walls, introducing blockade, and exercising sanctions pressure on Belarus and Russia. Due to that, of particular importance is the new North-South corridor. It's important financially and logistically, and it's important to fill it with concrete projects bringing together both Belarus and Russia. But don't you think that now that the Asia is on the rise and the East is on the rise, we have not just to develop the material infrastructure, we should also pay greater attention to the cultural and humanitarian component to make sure that our ideas and values coincide with the Asian countries, Eastern countries?
Yes, you're quite right, but that's the work that we're doing, not only because someone is erecting walls from the West, but we've just always done that. You see that the main part of the population of Russia is situated in the European part. However, the vast majority of the territory is beyond the Ural Mountains. So Russia is a Eurasian country, and we always keep that in mind, and we always remember that. We have traditionally developed our relations with the Asian countries. And especially now when we see this explosive growth, well, not right now, but over the course of several years, we've kept track of that. So to a major extent, we have reorientated our cooperation with the Asian countries. Naturally, it is impossible to develop economic ties without paying attention to the humanitarian component. To a certain extent, China and India are the cradles of the global civilization. And we've always had greatest respect for that, and attention as well as interest. The interest from the Russian community has always been great. Indeed, India study schools and China study schools studying cultures of these nations, because they are also multinational countries. We have very high level of studies and science in those spheres. That is traditional for Russia, and we'll continue to maintain that. Dear colleagues, we've started the already exceeded 3 hours of our work. I think we have already abused the time of the president of the Russian Federation. One acute question. Does anyone have that? No? Okay. There is one. Okay. Yes, please raise your hand.
Pilanim Tembu from South Africa, the Institute for Global Dialogue. Mr. President, you said that the West is not capable of unilaterally governing the whole of humanity, and that we need to build a symphony of human civilization. I'm interested in just an expansion of your thoughts on if we are to build a multipolar world order, on the importance of regional cooperation as a means of reinforcing and building the blocks of multipolarity. And then just a few words in terms of Russia's engagement with Africa, particularly related to the Russia-Africa summit. Thank you.
We have traditionally good relations with Africa on the whole, including South Africa, dating back to the times of the African fight for independence, of fighting against colonialism. And this unique relationship has been built over the time when Soviet Union, then Russia, has supported African states in their fight for their freedom. And this is the foundation of our relationship of the past decades, should be naturally used in the new conditions in order to build multilateral relations with the African states today, including South Africa, which, as we know, is a very effective and efficient partner within BRICS as well. We cherish that. We know the capacity of the South African Republic, and we're sure about the future of the African continent. And naturally, we'll develop our relationship with the African countries. Considering the traditional relations, also building new relationship with the countries in Africa. As to the essence of your question and its first part, I think I've already responded. I don't think I can really give it to you in a nutshell to give you all of the details of my position, but I think we need to strike a balance of interests. It is impossible to do in the conditions of hegemony of anyone trying to maintain hegemony of one country or a group of countries over the rest of humanity. And the hegemon will have to consider the legitimate demands of the majority of global participants, and not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. Well, everyone is for supporting African countries, but just in their speeches. But what happens in practice? For example, what is being used today, the tool of dollar or other currencies, for example, euro. What is happening in reality? $5.9 trillion were printed, and 2.9 trillion euros were printed over the past years. Where did this money go? It all went to buy up goods in global markets. And the United States turned from being into a producer and exporter of food into an importer of food. They started to buy up foods due to the fact that they have the printing press. That's what financial monopoly leads to. We have deficit right away. There were low harvests previous years, then the pandemic cut down in production, but they've printed a lot of money in fighting the pandemic. They've given it to their population. The prices went up. And who suffers first and foremost? African countries, well, Latin America and Asia as well. Is anyone thinking about that? Naturally, those who are doing that, they think about that. They don't care about the consequences. They have their own interests in mind. regardless of the consequences for the African countries, for example. And the same is happening on the other part of the food market, I mean fertilizers. How can that happen? I'll repeat it once again. How was it possible to make a decision to lift the restrictions and limitations to the Russian fertilizers in Europe and then provide a clarification on that, that these limitations are lifted only for the countries of the European Union? Are they out of their minds? They have done it in written fashion, that written all down, this clarification, but they do it without shying away from that. Is that observing the balance of interests? We said it multiple times. We have 300,000 tons of fertilizers arrested in the European ports. Our companies are prepared to give it away for free, but they don't allow that. We're prepared to give that to the African countries. Some leaders have asked me to where specifically this fertilizer is stored. 300,000 tons, that's millions of dollars. Just give it away to the poorest countries. They need it. No, they won't do it. Is that striking a balance of interest? If you want to fight against Russia, well, do that. You don't want us to have extra profits? It's okay. We're just giving it away for free to the developing countries. But what they are doing is only pushing the prices up, global prices up. They have an interest in that, seemingly. Is that a balance of interest? How do we achieve a stable relationship? We need to strike this balance. We need to act according to the norms that we're calling the norms of international law. We need to agree on them and then to stick to them. Also, in financial sphere, we need to create an independent financial system of payments that I have already mentioned. I've given you specific examples. What the unlimited emission of main currencies leads to, it has practical consequences, including and primarily for the developing countries. I want to go back to that. So, for the world to be stable, we need to achieve a balance of interest. Yes, please. Someone was raising hand over there. Okay. Yeah, please give them the mic. Who was raising the hand? Natalia, I think.
Yes,
please. Do you think
you don't look like Natalia.
Come for a deeper integration of the space of the ex-Soviet Union? And my second question is, what is your message to the simple, average citizen of a Western country, if you had in front of you such a citizen, what would be your message?
Well, the first thing, as for the integration, that is a very delicate matter. And I think that we need to do the same thing. I think the same thing applies to what I was saying. We need to strike a balance of interests. And it needs to be done professionally, without haste. Consistently. We have certain plans within the Eurasian Economic Union. It has to do with lifting of the limitations on the most important groups of goods to ensure complete freedom of movement of finance, capital, human capital, and goods. I don't think we need to get ahead of ourselves as it happened in the European Union, because certain countries with a certain level of development got into Eurozone and later they didn't know what to do because they had issues. When the inflation instrument becomes unavailable to offset the situation in the economy. For example, the well-known Greece situation that applies to other countries as well. We shouldn't get ahead of ourselves, but we need to be consistent in the implementation of the plans that we have outlined. We know what needs to be done in this direction, and we'll do it, considering the positions of all participants of the process. As for our message to the regular citizens of the Western countries, of the United States, and Europe, I'd like to say the main thing. Fight for higher wages. Now, that's number one. Do not believe that Russia is your enemy or adversary. Russia is your friend. And for decades, we've done everything, and we are prepared to do that in the future to strengthen our relationship. In this regard, it just came to my mind a short funny story that I told my colleagues. One of my friends from Germany told me this funny story recently. Imagine a family. A father, well, a son asks his father, "Father, why is it so cold?" And the father answers, "Because Russia has attacked Ukraine." And the child asks, "And what do we have to do with that?" "We introduced the sanctions against Russians." "What for?" "For them to suffer." "Are we Russians?" I'd like to say that all issues, here I'm appealing to the citizens of the European Union and to the US as well, all issues that manifest themselves have nothing to do with Russian actions. It has to do with systemic failures of your political leadership, of the political leadership of your countries, in energy, in food, and in monetary policy. That has led to an unprecedented inflation and energy deficit. Russia has nothing to do with it. That is the result of systemic mistakes of the leadership of your country. There needs to be a sober stock taken of the situation, and you need to strive for the change of the policy, of the economic policy. As for the international policy, this is always a sovereign decision of the countries, but it needs to be based on the opinion of the electorate, of the voters, regular citizens of the country. But the citizens must know, and I'll finish with that, with what I've started with. Russia is not an enemy, and it never had any nefarious intentions against the European countries or United States. And we know that Russia has a lot of friends there. We'll build our relationship with the so-called collective West built based on that part of the population of the European countries and the United States. And the call to fight for higher wages, does it apply to the Russian citizens as well? Yes, great. Everyone has heard that. And I have to say that this is one of the principled issues that the government should deal with. And the trade unions are doing that precisely, despite everything, despite special operations, or there is a complex dialogue in trilateral commission between the representatives of the employer, trade unions, and the government. This dialogue continues. We see that the nominal wages of the population is increasing. However, the real disposable income has decreased. I mean the state of the Russian economy. With that state, we can solve this issue, and we need to do that in accordance with the plans of the Russian government. I hope that all tasks that we're facing will be solved. Thank you. So, well, I think, Mr. President, do not give orders here. I give orders here. I think this is called hegemony. Well, we haven't overcome it yet. Colleagues, I suggest we do a rapid Q&A. Let's start with Natalia, who was left out, then two other questions, and we'll wrap it up. Natalia, please. Good evening. Natalia Cesar, African Business Initiative Center. I've been doing international relationships for 15 years and public diplomacy as well. I'm a person who builds bridges. It's important for me to project the future actions. It's apparent that we're facing a new historical era. So when we turn the chapter of the current events, we'll need to shape new or other institutions for international partnership. And I think that we're not talking about the countries who've decided which side they're on, but countries who, due to their geopolitical situation, cannot openly express their position. Mr. President, how do you see the future institutions for international partnership? What kind of foundation for parity can Russia propose at the international level? What kind of faces, instruments, and mechanisms we need to find new partners, allies, and friends? Not just words, but in responsible way. Do you think that there is a need for a change, for us to build new approaches in international partnership of the future? Well, you know, you had a very wide question, if we call it a question. I think it's more of a position. What I wanted to say that I've basically answered that, what you've just asked. We should and we can highlight the cooperation primarily with the countries who are sovereign in making their fundamental decisions. That's number one. Number two, we need to attain consensus when making decisions. And number three, to achieve balance of interest. What kind of institutions could serve that purpose? Universal international institutions. And number one here is the United Nations. Alan Freeman, please.
Mr. President, I come from Canada, a NATO country, whose future Prime Minister's grandfather was a banderista. We've heard the worldwide opposition to the stance of NATO and the many voices that exist in the global south. Those voices also exist in the north. They also exist in the collective west. Why don't we hear them? Because they are suppressed. Just look at what happened to Julian Assange. The media, the political elites, the academic elites have mounted an unprecedented campaign which is racist and Russophobic, which intimidates people to prevent them expressing the full extent of their disagreement with what their governments are doing. And so you do not see here the full extent of the opposition that exists in Europe, in Canada, in the United Kingdom. You don't see it. What can we do to build relations between those in the collective West that are fighting what their governments are trying to do and the support that exists in the global South and in Russia for Russia's courageous actions and position in world politics?
Well, I think no one should sacrifice anything. As far as their national interests go, you have to fight for your national interests. And we will work in harmony with you, in sync, as it were. Certainly, we do not know in detail how the political fight is unfolding in the collective West. Something you've just said, you know far better than I do what's happening over there. You know that, as far as our opposition goes, special services are working with it. You know how the West is acting. Hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, are spent via different channels to support opposition in our country. They're coming up with different ways of sending these resources over, and we find it hard to keep track and keep up. But we're not doing anything like that. But be that as it may, as I said in my speech, our very position on the fundamental issues of development, of international relations in particular, of development of society, we believe this position is attractive to a large number of people, not just in the West, but across the world. We know there are many supporters, many proponents over in the Western countries, and based on these proponents and supporters, we will build further our relations with the collective West. And to you, I would like to wish you every success in your fight for your national interests. I think this will be sufficient for us to be able to build good relations with Russia. Well, let's give me the last word. I would like to ask to raise your hand. Well, anyone who is there, raise your hand and I'll answer your question. Gabashtia, please. Good evening, Mr. President. At the beginning of our conversation, you said a lot about the special military operation. You spoke about the goals, your assessment of the situation. My question is as follows. On February the 24th, did you think that after 8 months, the operation would still be there, not just still continuing, but even getting worse? Now many people in the world are scared that a third world war could erupt. And you know, one of my favorite cities on the post-Soviet territory is Odessa. Give me a piece of advice. If I want to go there, say next summer, or maybe in 2 years, well, do not tarry. Go there as soon as possible. Oh, that's a joke. Okay. In 2 years, maybe. And what visa should I apply for? Ukrainian or Russian? If I want to go there. You know, Odessa is truly one of the world's most beautiful cities. As is known, Odessa was founded by Catherine II. And even most extreme nationalists are reluctant, you know, to bring down the monument to the founder of the city. Odessa can be an apple of discord. Or it can be a symbol of conflict resolution. It can serve as a symbol of a solution that can be found to everything that is currently unfolding, but it's not up to us. On many occasions we said that we are open to negotiations. And when I spoke at the Kremlin just some time ago, I said that publicly once again, but the current leaders of the Kyiv regime have decided not to pursue talks with Russia. There are many, but, you know, there are those who have this final say in Washington, and it's very easy for them, you know, to solve this issue. They need to give the proper signal to Kyiv for them to change their position to seek a peaceful solution. And that'll do it. As for your possible voyage to Odessa, jokes aside, I recommend you should go there. It's a good, beautiful city with beautiful traditions and history. It's worth seeing and admiring. Well, when I last was in Odessa, it didn't give me the best impression. You know, the utility sector back then was in disarray. You could see, judging by the facades of the buildings, it was better at the center, but should you take a step outside the center, it was not as presentable, but still, Odessa is worth looking at. And the last question, yeah. Carlos Ron, Venezuela, we cannot do without it. Well, we would like to give the last question to someone from Russia, probably.
Greetings from Venezuela, and from President Nicolas Maduro, your friend. You know, right now, about 30% of countries around the world are under some kind of illegal sanctions from the United States. You mentioned defending the principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter. Last month, the group of friends in defense of the Charter met in New York, and one of the issues they addressed was contributing to create a zone free of illegal sanctions where business can take place and we can be free of those impositions. What do you think Russia can do to help create this space, and how do you envision that this can happen? And if you have a message also for the people of Venezuela. Thank you.
Russia.
You see? Russia counters sanctions that have been imposed on us. And through these very actions, Russia creates a certain space of freedom to free you of fear of sanctions pressure, to make it possible to develop ties between different regions and different countries. No specific decisions are required in that regard. The very example we give, I think, is very instructive. A colleague of yours has just asked me what signal we can send to the citizens of the West. I told him about these signals, and I also spoke about the errors committed by the leadership of the West in the global economy and global finance, in energy, in food. A testimony to that, you know, there are sanctions introduced against Venezuela, whereas Venezuela is one of the biggest world oil producers, well, until recently. Iran faces sanctions. Russia is also under sanctions. There is a threat of sanctions against Saudi Arabia currently. There are also plans to introduce an oil and gas price cap for Russian oil and gas. At each and every step, they commit mistakes that result in most grave consequences for the countries that introduce sanctions at the very beginning. And then they're trying to find someone to blame, even though they're the ones at the origin of these consequences. But all that notwithstanding, Venezuela is still developing. Yes, there are problems, but Venezuela is overcoming them. Look at sanctions against Russia. When they were introduced, our economy was expected to collapse, and we spoke about that at the beginning of our today's meeting. The blitz against the Russian economy failed. As you can see, our inflation rate is going to be 12% by the end of the year, more or less. And there is a downward trend. In the first quarter of next year, our experts project inflation to stand at around 5%, whereas European developed nations are facing 17% in the Netherlands, 23% in some other countries, so it's twice as high as here. Our employment rate is 3.8%. It's slower during the pandemic. Before the pandemic, it was 4.7%. The budget deficit next year is projected to be 2%, then 1.4%, and in a year, 0.7%. And it's almost in all Eurozone nations, it's higher. Our public debt is several, you know, by magnitudes, it's smaller than in the US or in the European countries. Yes, to contract by 2.9, 2.8%. Yes, it's going to contract. But the industrial output and the manufacturing will stay at the same level. The construction sector has grown by 5% during the first 8 months of this year, 5.1%. Our agriculture has doubled. We see a bigger volume of lending both to the corporate sector and to consumers. We are witnessing a growth in lending. It's true there are some issues due to an outflow of money from the banks due to the events you're well aware of, but right now the money is getting back because rather than keep money in a box at home, losing it due to inflation, it's better to put the money in the bank because our banking system is highly resilient, so the lending rates are going up. You asked me what Russia can do to create conditions, to be free of these sanctions, to develop steadily. I think it's a good example. We have to band the efforts together. The efforts of those who are all interested in that, we need to achieve agreement and a balance of interest, as I have pointed out on many occasions, and then success will be ours. And I think, we can end. We can wrap it up at last. Mr. President, at the outset, I said we were expecting you with impatience, and I think we're leaving here satisfied. It'll give us a lot to think about. I sit in this chair, and I think impressions can differ, but I think this is one of our most successful discussions, given the range of topics and the overall ambience. A huge thank you, and we're already impatient to see you next year. I would like to say thank you to our moderator, and I would like to thank all of you for the interest you are showing in the relations with Russia. I refer to our foreign guests, and as far as all the experts of the Valdai Discussion Club are concerned, I would like to say thank you for working on this platform. Indubitably, you make a great contribution, tangible contribution, to the brainstorms that are in such great demand to take decisions at the practical level. A huge thank you to all of you.